You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Dale Brumfield, who is an adjunct English professor and the author of 7 books, his last 2, Richmond Independent Press and Independent Press in D.C. and Virginia, An Underground History, were both nominated for Library of Virginia Literary Awards in nonfiction. Dale Brumfield is a weekly history columnist for the Stanton News Leader and is a frequent contributor to Richmond Magazine, Style Weekly, and North of the James Magazine. His work has also appeared in the Richmond Free Press, Richmond Times-Dispatch, and USA Today. And his next book, A History of the Virginia Penitentiary, will be published in the fall of 2017. He has a website at dalebrumfield.net. Dale, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Great to be here, David. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you on. I've seen your work before. I think we've been in touch before, but I was struck by this column you had in the Richmond Times-Dispatch about capital punishment, state murder in Virginia. I think the timely part of this was that there are new standards for secrecy in how you kill someone in a prison in Virginia. What is that all about?
Yes, what has happened is, since the state, like many other states, have switched to lethal injection, the pharmacies that provide the needed drugs, which are 3 drugs that they use in a sequence in lethal injection processes, the pharmacies that provide these drugs are getting wise to states like Virginia, and they're saying, you can't have these anymore. You're using them to kill people. You know, our mission statement is to save lives, not to end lives. So when the pharmacies started denying the drugs, Virginia initiated a new protocol in which they would get the needed drugs from secret compounding pharmacy. We have no idea who they are, and we have no idea what is in the drug. We don't know if it's the drugs that are supposed to be or if they've got rat poison in them. There's absolutely no reason, no way we can know. So this secrecy that was initiated, not just in the drug and the pharmacy, but in the process. There was some trouble with the last execution in Virginia with Ricky Gray. And so the state has decided to not let the witnesses view the insertion of the IVs because apparently that was a problem with Ricky Gray. And so now the curtain is not open to the witnesses until after the criminal is strapped down to the gurney and IVs are already inserted. My point was this legacy of secrecy actually harkens back to the late 1800s in Virginia when secrecy was initiated to stop various celebrations going on at hangings and to remove mostly black tradition and influence from the process. So that was the whole point of the entire commentary.
It seems like pharmacies or drug companies or sellers of drugs and medicine generally have to rank pretty high up on the list of evil entities in the general popular conception. But here, you know, the state of Virginia is doing something that's beyond the pale for these corporations. I mean, that ought to say something about the morality of the state of Virginia.
Yes, it does in a way. It's like it appears that Virginia is just so dead set on executing that they're willing to bend over backwards and submit to these behind the scenes and underhanded things to keep this process going. Now, you know, as I stated in my editorial, Virginia received $340 worth of a drug called rhodium bromide, which is one of the 3 drugs in the cocktail given in the lethal injection process. And when Cardinal Health sold it to Virginia, but then XGen Pharmaceuticals who was actually the manufacturer of the drug, found out about Cardinal Health's sale, they were very concerned about that. They said, well, hold on, you know, and so I'm not sure what X-Gen's take on, you know, more supplies of this drug is. They may cut Virginia off entirely. I don't know. So they were very surprised that this drug was used. So just add them to another long list of pharmacy companies who have suddenly said, no, you can't have these drugs.
Yeah, we should be urging them in that direction and applauding them when they do right.
Absolutely. Absolutely, we should.
And this secrecy, you know, just before we get to the history of the secrecy, there's actually requirements of transparency now, you say, that are violated by the current procedure.
That's correct. These protocols, the American Bar Association has come out with a document in which they take a very strong stand on transparency in the execution process. They're saying if you're going to execute people, they don't take a stand necessarily for or against the death penalty, but what they're saying is if you're going to execute someone, then you've got to be completely out in the open with it. We've got to see everything. We've got to know the drugs. We should know who compounded the drugs. We should know. We should see the entire process from when the prisoner walks into the chamber till the execution is carried out in full, or until the execution is canceled, whichever the case may be.
Yeah.
So it's in direct defiance of what the American Bar Association is trying to establish. So, you know, that's what's rather disturbing, that Virginia is moving in that direction, away from accepted standardized procedures of what the legal community is saying.
Yeah, well, most of the world and most of the U.S. states are moving toward the abandonment of the death penalty. That there is no accepted procedure for state murder in most of the world, right? I mean, that's the trend that Virginia is bucking, right?
That is absolutely correct. Virginia and the few states in the United States left who have the death penalty are actually keeping company with countries like China, North Korea, Yemen, and Syria. These are the other countries who still have the death penalty. You know, most of the civilized world has long abandoned it. I recently was on a flight back from South Africa, and a young woman from Great Britain was sitting beside me, and I was actually writing this commentary while I was on the plane, and since we were packed in like sardines, she was looking at me. She goes, "May I ask what you're working on?" And I said, "Well, yeah, it's a piece about the death penalty." And she was just astonished. She said, "You still have the death penalty in the United States?" I said, "Well, we do in Virginia." And she said, "You know, it's funny. In Great Britain, we look to the United States as such a progressive country. But then we find out you still do things like the death penalty." I said, "Yeah, I know. So, it's like people are astonished that we still are clinging to these British colonial laws of the 17th century almost.
Well, some people are astonished. Some people are well aware and despise the United States for it. And when I go join peace movement events in the United Kingdom, they certainly do not look to the United States as a moral leader. But I wonder how far popular opinion in the United States is behind the rest of the world. I've seen polls suggesting only a third of us here in Virginia actually support the death penalty.
It's eroding. That support is eroding, and it's a long, slow process. When the government keeps doing it, people tend to be more accepting of it. And they say, well, you know, it's all part of law and order. You know, we have to have law and order. We need it, you know, as a deterrent. But, you know, none of these excuses hold up under scrutiny. To my knowledge, there has not been a death sentence handed out in a court in Virginia since around 2011.
Yeah.
So, you know, is it truly acting as a deterrent? I don't think so. You can't certainly use that as any indication. You can't bring up cost. We all know it costs far more. You know, no studies have been done in Virginia, but they've been done in other states. It costs far more to keep a prisoner on death row per year than it does in general population. So you can't use that argument. There literally are no rational arguments that can uphold the death penalty. It's all based on emotion.
Well,
and only emotion drives vengeance. It doesn't drive law and order.
Well, I'll Dale Brumfield, I'll give you a rational argument. I won't say it's a moral one, but they run so many people through the so-called justice system in Virginia, and they don't have time to give them their right to a trial or a jury. My goodness. So the death penalty is a key part of endless plea bargains. You know, take this
exactly.
plea bargain, innocent, guilty, or somewhere in between, take this plea bargain and we won't kill you. I mean, isn't that what they keep it around for?
Well, I think so. It's just a bargaining chip in that case. And I'm sure, you know, make a deal with us and we'll spare you the death penalty. You know, and so deals are made. I think, you know, one of the Beltway snipers, the young guy, Malvo, Leboy Malvo, took that. They said, you know, we won't kill you. Even though you were the trigger man, we won't kill you if you hand us John Allen Muhammad.
Yeah.
Or something to that effect. The same way with Ricky Gray and his partner Dandridge, who killed all these people in Richmond. You know, Dandridge got a better deal. You know, he was willing to strike a deal to avoid the death penalty, so he got life in prison, whereas Ricky Gray was the one who wound up getting killed for those. So, yeah, you're right. It is kept there. It seems like it's being kept around as a bargaining chip in that respect.
Let's talk about what was the focus of this column of yours, Dale Brumfield, in the Richmond Times-Dispatch. You said that the secrecy around the death penalty in Virginia started in 1879, I think, in response to a gallows ball. What was that?
Well, it was in New Kent County. Now, back in the just after the Civil War, hangings were done in various localities around Virginia. Executions were not centralized at that time. And what happened in New Kent Courthouse, they hung two young black men who had been accused of murder, 20 and 21 years of age. And what had happened was black people were back then were recognizing the injustice behind the criminal justice program in Virginia and knowing that, you know, most blacks, especially young black men who were being hung at that time, were probably innocent or guilty of lesser crimes, yet they were still being hung. So they saw that as a reason of rejoicing. They started having parties at hangings to welcome the young men into the promised land. You know, it wasn't to condemn their past crimes. It was to welcome them and, you know, show them look forward to going to heaven. And so they became a party. And in New Kent, that party reached a whole new level of extremity. And when they had what they called a gallows ball, after they hung these two young men, 1,000 people gathered in a tobacco barn, and they had a huge party that lasted all night. They even had a what they called a voodoo priestess come in, and she said that if you get some clothing from the recently deceased, you will live 90 years forever. Some of them ran out to the gravesite and disturbed two resurrectionists who were actually digging the graves up to take them to the Medical College of Virginia for dissecting. It just got crazy. And the General Assembly was mortified by this New Kent gallows ball, it was called. It was being reported nationwide. There were newspaper articles in Ohio about this gallows ball. So the literally 2 or 3 months after that, the General Assembly in session said, no more. Okay, hangings are not going to be public anymore. We got to stop the partying. We got to stop these black people from coming and getting together and turning this into a big party. So they passed a law that said that hangings had to be private. Now, all that meant was the hanging had to take place within an enclosure or in an area where people could not be so readily available to see it. So the law basically went nowhere because people could climb on top of the wall. If they built the wall, people would look over it. People would gather on a hillside to watch. There were still hundreds of people would gather for these hangings. So that's when they recognized, well, you know, this 1879 law is not really doing what we intended it to do. Okay, so then in 1908, they put their foot down, and they said, you know, the General Assembly said, you know what, no more outdoor hangings. We're going to centralize all the executions in Virginia, in Richmond, in the basement of the penitentiary in Richmond, and at the last minute, they decided to switch from hanging to the electric chair. And now, instead of having, you know, hangings in front of large groups of chanting, praying, and partying black people, people were going to be killed in an electric chair in front of six somber witnesses in a grim basement in a penitentiary.
Yeah.
So that was the big switch. That's when they finally put their foot down and said, this is part of the secrecy process. They were removing, you know, the party atmosphere. They didn't want all these people partying, chanting, praying, and having all this frivolity and a hanging. So they just put it in the basement.
So the reason for the secrecy at that point, early 20th century, was to avoid the embarrassment of what the public would do. The reason for the secrecy now, I assume, is to avoid the embarrassment of what the state government is doing. Is that right?
Exactly. They're worried that, you know, if there's a mistake, if there's a problem, if the condemned shows pain, any of these things, is to cover all that up, to shield anyone from any type of culpability, it seems like, in the process.
Yeah.
So my whole point was this shielding, this protecting, this secrecy is just part of a long line of a very racist legacy that we still persist in clinging to. And that's what I find so difficult to understand.
What are the statistics in terms of the racist slant of the use of the death penalty historically and then recently?
Well, historically, it was overwhelmingly black. Of the first, I studied and researched the first 100 executions in the electric chair in Virginia from 1908 to 1921. And I found that of that 100, 99 were men, one was a woman, and I believe 86 of the 100 were black. So that's an 86%, that's pretty out there. That's very extreme.
Probably five times the percent in the population, maybe.
Five times the percent of the population, probably at least, something like that. Now, today, since 1982, you know, there's a moratorium on the death penalty in Virginia from 1962 to 1982. There were concerns about the electric chair being an adequate form of capital punishment, and there were some other distinguishing characteristics then that caused many states to temporarily abandon the death penalty. But they brought it back. A couple of court cases in the late 70s brought it back. And then in 1982, Virginia resumed executions, and it has been exactly 54 white executions and 54 black executions and 4 foreign nationals since 1982. So it is perfectly split down the middle now. So some people may use that as an excuse to say, well, the death penalty is no longer racist because we're equally split between black and white.
But the population is not.
But the population is not. You're exactly right. And even more importantly, in Virginia, a study has shown, and right now the group escapes me, a study has shown that since 1982, if you kill someone, you are 3 times more likely to be sentenced to death if your victim is white.
Yeah. So it's racism if you look at the race of the victim. Yeah.
It is racist toward the victim, exactly. So that's where we are still seriously falling down, and that's where the racist legacy lies today. Whereas before, it was who we were executing. Now it's like it pertains to the victims.
Dale Brumfield, we in Virginia, I think, don't realize that many U.S. states have not killed anyone for many years, that it's a handful of states really dominating this barbaric practice. And we sometimes think, oh, well, Texas is the worst. I think maybe in statistics in recent years, Texas has killed the most. But Virginia, you say, has the all-time record. Is that true?
Yes, that is absolutely true. Virginia started executing in 1608. 1 year after Jamestown was settled, a man named Thomas Kendall was shot by a firing squad for conspiring against the English with the Spanish. So the first execution, we started doing it so much earlier here. Now, it's true, since 1976, Texas has executed over 500 people. That by far leads the nation since 1976. But if you go all the way back to the beginning, Virginia has executed 1,388 people since 1608, whereas Texas has executed about 1,290 people since they started executing in 1812. So, we started doing it about 200 years earlier. But we still have the lead. We still lead by about 90. So, you know, wow, what a record to have.
Yeah, number one.
We're number one.
There's a branch of this organization called the Innocence Project here at the University of Virginia at the law school in Charlottesville.
Right.
And they're having an event this week with, I think, five or six speakers who were all exonerated from death row in Virginia. And there's many years ago, I was a reporter for a newspaper in Culpeper, and I wrote long articles about another one who's not among this group, named Earl Washington, who was exonerated from death row in Virginia. There does seem to be quite a problem with putting innocent and often black and often poor and often low IQ individuals on death row, where if you kill them, it's a little late to say, I'm sorry. And even the I'm sorries for locking you up for decades seem a little bit insufficient to me.
Exactly. I have worked with a couple of people, a couple of prisoners, spoken to them and interviewed them who were set free by the work of the Innocence Project, including Thomas Hainsworth. Thomas was, in 1983 or 84, was a victim of, he himself was a victim of victim misidentification. Five women incorrectly identified him as their rapist.
Yeah.
And it was not him. DNA exonerated him after he served in Nottoway Correctional for 27 years. And, you know, you have to credit Governor Bob McDonald and Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli for working to get him out as quickly as possible after the DNA exonerated him. The Earl Washington case is fascinating because, you know, Mr. Washington was 7 days away from being executed when DNA exonerated him. Look how close we came. And that that exoneration had a very powerful effect on a man named Jerry Gibbons, who was Virginia's executioner at the time. Mr. Gibbons was the executioner from 1982 until 1999 in Virginia, and I interviewed him for Richmond Magazine, and he said, you know, he really could have never forgiven himself if he'd have executed Earl Washington. And he said that is one thing that turned him away from being the executioner and from the death penalty, was the Earl Washington case. It was a close call that never should have happened.
Although the prosecutors and police and everyone involved in the court system and the public and the people who elected that Commonwealth's attorney in Culpeper, for the most part, seem to have brushed it off and forgiven themselves quite easily. Whereas if you just go and read the transcript of the trial and the testimony from the police, the idea that he was conceivably guilty just seems absurd. I think the idea was that he was a poor black man, because the police testified openly in court that they fed him every bit of information. That they didn't ask him, what were you wearing? They held up a shirt in front of him and said, this was your shirt, wasn't it? And so on. You know, this is how they did it was a sort of an open and blatant frame-up, as far as I could tell.
And unfortunately, I hate to bring this up publicly, but, you know, Mr. Washington is a very low IQ. And he was coerced into a confession, and he was simply led to believe that he had actually committed these acts and done these things, when in fact he was clueless. I mean, I really feel sorry that this man was just so taken advantage of by these overzealous prosecutors. And we see that over and over. The Keith Harwell case, Keith was in jail for 33 years based on bite marks. He was prosecuted on bite marks in a rape and murder.
Right.
And they've since come back and said, you know, we can't use bite marks. They're not like fingerprints, you know. But he served 33 years in a Virginia prison, based on, an overzealous prosecution. And it happens so easily, especially when there's a rush to convict. There's a rush to find someone to pin the crime on. you know, hey, we got the guy, let's take care of this. And of course, once the execution occurs, it's too late. All evidence is destroyed. It's as if, you know, by Virginia law, it's as if the person never existed. So there's no way to come back and find out if that person was truly innocent or not.
Yeah, incredible. I think you even mentioned in your column this scandal here in Charlottesville of some of us trying to get rid of a statue of Robert E. Lee and the statewide outrage. But it's not... The racism that put up these statues in the 1920s is not entirely gone from conduct in the state of Virginia, is it?
No, obviously it is not. It's still happening, and I think everything surrounding the use of the death penalty in Virginia is a continuing that racist legacy. You know, forget the monuments. Look what's going on right here in criminal justice proceedings.
Yeah.
So, yes, you're exactly right.
We have just a few minutes left. Have you been following at all what's been happening this week with the death penalty in, I believe it's Arkansas?
Yes, I've been following that very closely. What an incredible situation. They were getting ready to execute, I think it was eight
criminals, men. Yeah.
8 men in 10 days. And they were having to do it quick. Hurry up and do it because the expiration dates are about to run out on the drugs.
Incredible. Yeah.
That is literally why they're rushing these executions. Now, they're trying to, give some PR balance to this by saying, well, these men have been on death row for 10 years. They've exhausted everything. They've done this. They've done that. But, you know, it's because the drugs, once the expiration dates are out on the drugs and they can't get any more. So this is what states are facing. You know, not only when these pharmacies, when these expiration dates run out and these pharmacies stop providing them, you know, what are they going to do then? You know, you have to either end the death penalty or move. What are you going to do, go back to the electric chair? Let's go back to, you know, medieval barbarism while we're at it. So I don't know what the future of it. I don't see a future for the death penalty. So mainly because of this, though, I don't know what's going to happen.
I certainly hope you're right, that they've convinced themselves that the drugs are the humane way to murder people, and they're unable to get the drugs, and they can't go to a non-humane way to murder people other than during war, and they'll have to end it.
You will talk to some people who say, why are we humanely putting these terrible criminals to death who did these terrible crimes? I hear that argument a lot. You know, this, like Ricky Gray, savagely murdered a family, including two little girls. Why are we humanely trying to put him to death when he did this? My answer to that is we have to show we are better than they are.
Yeah, but that's the logic, if you can call it that, of revenge, is to seek revenge.
I never denied that Ricky Gray should die for his crimes. I do think he should die for his crimes. I don't think we have the moral authority to kill him. And Jerry Givens called it death in prison. You put someone in a concrete box for years, decades in some cases, they have nothing to look forward to but dying.
Well, you bring out a dramatic disagreement with me with 3 seconds left in the program, so we'll have to have you back on. Dale Brumfield, forthcoming book about the Virginia Penitentiary, maybe when it comes out, we'll have you back. Thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Senator Elizabeth Warren put it pretty clearly to the now former CEO of Wells Fargo when she said, quote, "You squeezed your employees to the breaking point so they would cheat customers and you could drive up the value of your stock and put hundreds of millions of dollars in your own pocket," close quote. But what that powerful statement still omits is that Wells Fargo didn't cheat any and all customers. Their fraud, opening some 2 million accounts for people without their knowledge, was targeted specifically at black and brown communities. The same communities at the sharp end of Wells Fargo practices in other arenas, like pipelines and private prisons. Activists are using this scandal to call attention to a range of other problems at the bank, problems not addressed by a couple of top executives giving back some of their golden parachutes. Saqib Bhatti is director of the Refund America Project and co-executive director of the Action Center on Race and the Economy. We'll talk with him about the Forgo Wells campaign. Also on the show, corporate media are very interested in Donald Trump's taxes, as well they should be. But there's plenty to be said about unfairness in the tax system even before we get to the tax dodger in chief. Jeremy Greer is vice president of policy and research at the Corporation for Enterprise Development. They say the tax code doesn't reflect inequality, it actually drives it. We'll talk with him about CFED's Turn It Right Side Up campaign. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. The New York Times is likely the single most influential newspaper in the English language world, not just because of its reach, but because it defines the boundaries of acceptable debate. Being in the New York Times is a legitimizing event. That's what comes to mind when you learn that the paper has just handed a biweekly opinion column to Wall Street Journal deputy editorial page editor Brett Stevens. It's not just that Stevens is yet another white man, like 9 of the other 12 current columnists, though it certainly is that. It's also that stamp of acceptable opinion being given to someone who, as folks like Hamilton Nolan at Fusion and Zed Jelani at The Intercept have documented, holds a number of opinions that could generously be termed fringe. He is a climate change denier, as listeners may have heard, but he's also an anti-Arab, anti-black racist, an advocate of torture, and a believer that the problem of campus rape is an imaginary enemy. As FAIR analyst Adam Johnson notes, Stevens has referred to anti-Semitism as the disease of the Arab mind, insisted Palestinians have a blood fetish, called Black Lives Matter a lie based on the myth of victimization, institutionalized racism is another imaginary enemy, and in a piece subtly headlined, "I am not sorry the CIA waterboarded," he contended that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, in fact, waterboarded himself by not being truthful with his captors. As Jelani points out, the Stevens hire is especially weird given the New York Times' current PR campaign as a pursuer of truth in an era of fake news. "The truth is more important now than ever," says a recent ad. And as Johnson notes, hiring Stevens highlights the radical asymmetry at work when considering what is and isn't fringe opinion. If you're going to the neocon right, apparently you can't go too far. But on the other end of the spectrum, anything to the left of Hillary Clinton is unacceptable, a fact that became abundantly clear during the 2016 primary, when all of the paper's liberal or pro-democratic columnists lined up behind Clinton, and Paul Krugman even claimed falsely that every serious progressive policy expert on either health care or financial reform who has weighed in on the primary favored Clinton. Krugman was the closest the page got to support for single-payer health care, supported by minimally a plurality of Americans and a majority of Democrats, and his position was that it's just not going to happen. What Brett Stevens' hire tells us, then, is that on the opinion page of the country's paper of record, things like universal health care or free college are pie-in-the-sky fantasies no serious person takes seriously, while climate denial and racism are the paper, so its editors say, bringing a new perspective to bear that further widens their vibrant diversity of opinions. Well, Bill O'Reilly's attorney issued a statement earlier this week saying that the Fox host was the victim of a brutal campaign of character assassination unprecedented in post-McCarthyist America, which he has irrefutable evidence is being orchestrated by far-left organizations for their own gain. It's not clear if that evidence will be forthcoming now that O'Reilly is out of his spot at the top of Fox's roster. It was, of course, the far-left New York Times that ran the story that appears to have started the snowball rolling, reporting earlier this month that Fox had paid some $13 million to settle at least five lawsuits from women who charged the host with things like verbal abuse, sexual comments, unwanted advances, and phone calls better left undescribed. Corporate advertisers, undeterred by O'Reilly's years of on-air racism, sexism, homophobia, Islamophobia, outright lying, and hate-mongering, evidently decided that that was a bridge too far. Okay. It's hard not to celebrate the end of the sheer toxicity O'Reilly's show put out, but activist groups like Ultraviolet, who worked for his ouster, underscore that the problem is bigger than him. Fox News executives gave cover for harassment and abuse for years. There's no reason to believe that culture has changed, particularly as the network won't make the results of their investigation public. The group Media Matters, who would assuredly have been cited by O'Reilly's lawyer, reminded that calling for boycotts of institutions he doesn't like were part of O'Reilly's stock in trade. His website still maintains a list of media outlets that traffic in defamation, and urges readers not to patronize or advertise with them. On that list is pretty much any outlet that makes any reference to his harassment history. The Dayton Daily News had the temerity to mention it, leading to a threatening call from O'Reilly's producer demanding they run an apology. When they didn't, O'Reilly told his audience that the paper had sympathy for child rapists. A Roanoke Times editor named Daniel Rodmacher mentioned harassment charges and poked fun at O'Reilly's War on Christmas thing, for which he and his paper were targeted on the host's TV and radio shows, with O'Reilly complaining to millions about, quote, extremely mean-spirited personal attacks on me by a guy named Dan Rodmacher, a left-wing loon. We did some research on him, and it's disgraceful. And they go on our don't buy, don't advertise list, Roanoke Times, because anybody who would employ a guy like that, and you know, and we did, we walked back and looked at what he did, is irresponsible. It's just horrible. Close quote. Who does that sound like? At Fair, we have mixed feelings about advertiser boycotts, which draw on the power corporate sponsors have to control content. But for that to be the thing that freed the airwaves of Bill O'Reilly, well, that's just karma. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Recently, executives of Wells Fargo were forced to give back some of the money they'd personally made from coercing employees to open and charge fees on some 2 million accounts for people without their knowledge, with, it should not be forgotten, a target on low-income and African-American communities. Millions of Americans are still struggling with the impact of these predatory measures and their like, and let's not forget either the more than 5,000 low-level employees Wells Fargo fired, as though they'd come up with the hyper-aggressive cross-selling goals themselves. The fact that this is the same Wells Fargo that is among the primary financial backers of the Dakota Access Pipeline, and the same Wells Fargo that bankrolls the expansive private prison industry, has led activists to address the company as not the only blameworthy financial industry actor, but a real crystallization of how banks finance racism. Saqib Bhatti is director of the Refund America Project and co-executive director of the Action Center on Race and the Economy. He works on a campaign called Forgo Wells. He joins us now by phone from Chicago. Welcome to Counterspin, Saqib Bhatti.
Great to be here. Well, I'd like to start with the fraudulent accounts, though I know that that's just one head of the Hydra. Media accounts are presenting the decision to take back some millions in compensation from Wells Fargo former CEO John Stumpf and Carrie Tolstead, who ran the community banking department at the center of the fraud. That clawback is being described as epic, the biggest in industry history, and so on. But I saw a piece by Peter Dreyer that suggested that media reports are leaving out some important bottom-up organizing work that played a role in getting to this development, but that is aimed actually at much more. Can you talk a little bit about the activism behind, whatever we may say, a still rare example of any price being paid by higher-ups for this really devastating behavior?
Yes, I mean, on that point, that's actually very interesting that it doesn't actually take all that much to be the highest fine ever paid by Wall Street, because actually it just doesn't happen. The point that was really at the heart of Peter Dreyer's article was a very important one, which is that the scandal around the fraudulent accounts was actually whistleblowers within the bank who were bank workers organizing with the Committee for Better Banks, who raises concern that as a matter of their employment, in order to keep their jobs, they're being forced to meet these aggressive sales goals, and in so doing, they're really being forced into open fraudulent accounts. There is a petition that the Committee for Better Banks launched 3 years ago before the scandal broke that got over 10,000 signatures. And so that's one of the key things that's actually very important, because the company cannot deny that they knew that this was happening. Because, in fact, 10,000 of their own workers signed a petition and gave it to them 3 years earlier saying, look, we're being forced to do this. We know this is illegal. We know this is wrong. It's unethical. We feel very bad about it. And the company continued to do those practices.
Yeah, and I think it's really exciting to hear about employees and consumers, you know, being in coalition around these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing that this is one of the things that's not as well understood in the United States, but in other parts of the world, bank workers are generally unionized. In places where bank workers are unionized, part of the role that the union is able to serve is to actually empower them to be whistleblowers, basically give them workplace protections so they can raise these issues and fight on behalf of consumers.
Well, Wells Fargo, as listeners will know, is one of some 17 banks financing the Dakota Access Pipeline. They're also deep in private prisons, which I heard an activist point out are targeted not because they're worse than public prisons, though they may be, but because they're expansionist and they rely on banks to do that. There's a theme here. You see a coherence in terms of the communities harmed by Wells Fargo, yeah?
Absolutely. It is no mere accident that time and again we find that when there are issues that are harming communities of color, if you look at where the money is coming from, it's almost always coming from Wall Street, and right at the head of the pack, you always have Wells Fargo. Racism isn't just a side effect of what Wells Fargo does. It's part and parcel of what it does, whether it's, as you mentioned, fighting the Dakota Access Pipeline or funding these immigrant detention centers and getting ready to profit off of Trump's heightened enforcement on immigration issues, or just going back to the fact that they were actually one of the leading banks when it came to mortgage discrimination, really targeting communities of color with predatory mortgages. In fact, workers from within the bank have come forth and said that within Wells Fargo, they referred to subprime mortgages as ghetto loans and said that they were intended for mud people. This is a type of culture that you had within Wells Fargo. They also help finance the payday lending industry, which preys on communities of color. And even with the scandal around fraudulent accounts, one of the lesser reported stories, the workers also came forward and said that they were actually targeting Spanish speakers in particular, right? So what we found is time and again, it's Black and Latino communities that are targeted for the worst of Wells Fargo's racist practices.
It seems so important to say it's not that it's an indifferent structural capitalism problem that just happens to hurt Black and brown people. It's really targeted that way.
exactly.
Well, when I look at media, I see a frame that bugs me, first of all, about how Wells Fargo was engulfed in scandal, you know, like it was a dust storm, and how executives took too long to recognize problems, when the fact is that they created the problems and called them policy.
Mm-hmm.
But the upshot is Wells Fargo is going back on the offensive, I learned, after months of apologizing, and that other banks are claiming that they would never, you know, nothing that really looks like change. And what I'd like to see more of is stories about, for example, Portland. You know, I read a piece in Truthout by Mike Ludwig where folks, some of whom were coming back from Standing Rock, are using people power. Can you tell us about how communities are using this point of intervention that we do have around local government investments and contracts?
Yes, around the country, people are saying that we've had enough of Wells Fargo really doing everything it can to extract as much value out of our communities as possible, and we're fighting back. And so the Fargo Wells campaign is really about getting cities, states, counties, school districts across the country to stop doing business with Wells Fargo. So we've had some great victories in cities like Seattle and Oakland. There's resolutions that have already passed saying that the cities will no longer do business with Wells Fargo and to start exploring alternatives. Separately from the resolutions, we've also had executive action in a number of places like Chicago, Illinois, Ohio, where in some cases treasurers, in other cases governors, mayors have themselves decided they're doing what they can to unilaterally move their money out of Wells Fargo as a result of this fraudulent account scandal. And so increasingly, what we're seeing is a movement from the bottom up that's really putting pressure on local elected officials to stand up to Wells Fargo and say that actually all banks are not the same. It's also true that many banks are problematic. Wells Fargo is not alone mm-hmm. in financing the Dakota Access Pipeline. But Wells Fargo is the worst. And so there is a grassroots movement to really hold Wells Fargo accountable.
Well, finally, I have heard the line that critics of divestment say essentially banks like Wells Fargo are so big that, you know, they're involved in everything and some of it's bad, you know, as if it were unavoidable. It sounds very close to we can't do everything, so let's do nothing. But what you're saying is we can do and are doing things, lots of things. What's happening April 25th?
April 25th is the day of the Wells Fargo shareholder meeting. This will be the first shareholder meeting since the fraudulent account scandal broke, since the resignation of the CEO. And so what we're doing is we're calling for a national day of action. We have a petition that we're circulating that you can access from fargowells.org that, you know, calls on the bank to divest from the Dakota Access Pipeline, stop investing and profiting from private prisons, immigrant detention centers, to stop funding the payday lending industry, to stop its tremendous lobbying that it's doing to try to influence our politics, to stop its predatory foreclosure practices, and a number of other demands that we raise. The petition also stands in support of the shareholder resolution that Wells Fargo's own shareholders are putting forth to try to change the bank's behavior, which again sort of calls for it to fix its gender pay gap. It calls on the bank to adopt an indigenous rights policy. And we're also finally calling for the resignation of the bank's directors. The board of directors who are supposed to oversee the bank, they were the CEO's boss, and they were all asleep at the switch. They completely looked the other way while the bank made disastrous policy decisions that were blatantly illegal and blatantly racist. And we're saying that it's time for those directors to go as well. So we have this petition. We have a sign-on letter. We're having a day of action where people will deliver those petitions to Wells Fargo branches across the country and demand that Wells Fargo change at the fundamental level, that they adopt these policies and to demand that they pass the shareholder resolutions and fire the board of directors.
We've been speaking with Saqib Bhatti of Refund America and the Action Center on Race and the Economy. You can learn more about the Wells Fargo campaign online at fargowells.org. Saqib Bhatti, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
The group ProPublica has exposed how efforts to make paying your taxes easy and free with a pre-filled filing from the government, as is done in parts of Europe, have been repeatedly derailed by vigorous lobbying from H&R Block and the makers of TurboTax. It's a kind of icing on the cake of a tax system that many suspect is unfair and slanted against the little guy. But while we complain about tax policy as bureaucratic or baroque, the impact of that policy goes well beyond irritation. Given its crucial place in U.S. society, the tax system should be transparent. But when those who are able to really look at the system and its societal impact, what do they find? Jeremy Greer is Vice President of Policy and Research at the Corporation for Enterprise Development and part of CFED's Turn It Right Side Up campaign. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Jeremy Greer.
Thanks for having me, Jenny.
Well, before we talk about taxes per se, could you speak a little about the difference between income and wealth and how that picture breaks down racially in this country?
So we think about income, and when we think about the interplay between income and wealth, there's a saying that we use here at CFED quite often is income helps you get by, but wealth helps you get ahead. Mm-hmm. Wealth is the thing that really provides security for your family. It allows your family to think forward to the future, think about things like thinking about your child's education, their higher education, thinking about retirement, what are you going to do when you stop working? Mm-hmm. So while income is important, that provides the resources for you to do that, wealth is something that really provides you that security to think long term. How that breaks down across the country as it relates to racial groups, you know, we did a study recently with the Institute for Policy Studies called The Ever-Growing Gap. And what we found is there is an incredible and really pervasive racial wealth divide, and much more divided than when you look at it by income. If we were to do nothing to change our policies or stop the trajectory, it would take African-American families 228 years to reach parity in wealth with white families, and would take almost 80 years for Latino families to reach parity with white families. So we have a huge wealth divide that is even larger for households of color than there even is when you look at income.
Well, I think some might think that the tax code favors the wealthy, but you say it's more than that, that the tax code drives inequality. How is that?
It does. The tax code is really one of the mechanisms in which wealth is distributed across various income groups and across various ends that the country likes to see. Just in 2015, the federal government spent on wealth-generating activities through tax expenditures, through expenditures through the tax code, about $660 billion. To give you a sense of the scale of that, that is more than the combined budgets of 14 cabinet-level agencies. Well, when you break that down and say, well, who's getting that wealth? What you find is that the top 1% of taxpayers, from an income standpoint, receive more than the bottom 80% of taxpayers combined. And we think that that's upside down. That is not how we think about how we make our investments. So where are these investments being made? They're being made in things like home ownership. You know, when you think about housing subsidies in this country, we tend to think about, you know, programs at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, public housing, Section 8, things like that. But actually, the largest housing subsidies come through the tax code. A little over $200 billion a year in housing subsidies are provided through the tax code to families, and most of them on the very high end. Things like the mortgage interest deduction, which accounts for about $100 billion in spending every year. State and local tax deductions, which account for a good share of the spending every year. So when you think about what's driving inequality, you know, I would say a federal system that is subsidizing the income and expenses and wealth at the high end at the expense of not investing at the low end is really exacerbating that divide.
What's behind it? What's driving that policy?
I would say the major thing that's driving it is special interests. When you look at our tax code system and you look where those benefits are being driven, it's in the places where there is a lot of lobbying dollars behind it. There's two major ways that people earn income in this country. You earn it by wages. Mm-hmm. You know, you go to your job, you get paid by an employer, and that's the exchange. Another way that people earn income in this country is through investment. You take your money, you put it in certain types of interest-bearing accounts, and you get a return on that investment, and that income comes back to your family. Well, the tax code taxes that in different ways. They tax your income at the high end at about 40%, and they tax that investment at the high end at about 20%. So basically what we're saying is that we will take a special and prioritize tax benefits to people that get investment income. And essentially, that is at cost to the government. So why is that? Well, people that get investment income happen to be on the high end. Only about 1% of the country makes investments in the stock market other than through their retirement. And those are the people that are in Congress lobbying to make it that way.
Right.
So when you think about the priority of prioritizing investment income over wages, a lot of that has to do with who's lobbying the Congress to make it that way.
Right. And low-income taxpayers don't have, first of all, that access and that power, but also we have this president who says, I don't pay any taxes and that makes me smart. Obviously, yeah. If you can afford lawyers and accountants, you know, that plays into it too.
Yeah, that's right. And from our standpoint, the way to change that dynamic is, you know, families aren't going to be able to outspend the special interest. I mean, nor should they. I mean, they're worried about putting food on the table, putting clothes on their kids' backs, you know, sending their kids to college. Those are the things that they're thinking about investing their money in. But what they can do is they can have a voice in the conversation. And the way to have a voice in the conversation is they have to be informed. They have to understand why it is the tax system is the way it is and begin to understand it. And there's a role for us in Washington, and that's really what the Turn It Right Side Up campaign is about. It's really educating everyday folks about why the tax code is important, what role it plays in your life. You know, if you feel like you spend too much money for your housing, there's a role that the tax system plays in creating that dynamic. You feel like, you know, you don't have the ability to pay for your kids' college and get them to college. There's a way that the tax code can have an impact on that. And really, our hope is that if we can educate everyday folks around why this is important and how they can engage, we can start to begin that conversation so that the people that we send to Congress hear from more than just a special interest.
Well, Jeremy, how can folks learn more about the Turn It Right Side Up campaign?
It's very simple. If you go to www.turnitrightsideup.org, they can get more information and join the campaign.
All right, then, turnitrightsideup.org. We've been speaking with Jeremy Greer of CFED. Thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine. It was great to talk to you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Almost a quarter of the land in the Northern Hemisphere is frozen, but this permafrost is thawing much faster than anyone thought possible. On our current course, almost half could be gone by the end of this century, rearranging the landscape and emitting massive amounts of greenhouse gases. Later in this program, we will talk with the lead author of the new study. But our first guest is the distinguished climatologist and geophysicist, Dr. Michael E. Mann. He's the director of the Earth System Science Center at Pennsylvania State University, author of three books, and the famous target of climate deniers for his early recognition of rapid global warming, dubbed the hockey stick graph. Michael Mann just testified to a rigged committee at the House of Representatives. He's also the lead author of New Science that shows how our weather has become more extreme due to human greenhouse gas emissions. Michael Mann, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's great to be with you.
Why do you think climate science is being attacked and dismantled by the government of the United States?
Well, there's really no other way to characterize it. The implications of the science, namely that we need to do something about our ongoing burning of fossil fuels and escalating greenhouse gas emissions that are warming the planet, the fact that we need to do something about that is a threat to the fossil fuel interests that fund the campaigns of folks like Donald Trump and congressional Republicans who are essentially acting as advocates for those special interests and doing everything they can to attack the science, to attack the scientists, and, as you know, to dismantle science-based policies to do something about the problem.
And you recently appeared on Capitol Hill at a hearing of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. How did that go?
Well, I was the sole representative, really, for sort of the mainstream scientific viewpoint, and there were three other witnesses who are all rather in the fringe of that small fringe of scientists who either do not accept the science, deny the basic science, or downplay the impacts of climate change. It's not surprising. The chair of the committee, Lamar Smith, a Texas Republican whose greatest contributors are all fossil fuel interests. They fund his campaigns, and in return, he has used, some would say abused, his authority as chair of the House Science Committee to use it as a tool to issue indiscriminate attacks against the science of climate change and climate scientists.
Can you list just a couple of fronts in this new war against climate science where the administration is trying to kill off either research or public information?
Yeah, so really it's a multi-pronged strategy on their part. Trump has appointed to key positions within his administration climate change deniers and lobbyists and individuals with strong ties to the fossil fuel industry. Look at his Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, the former CEO of the world's largest fossil fuel corporation, ExxonMobil. And if you look at who he's appointed to the EPA, Scott Pruitt. Scott Pruitt was the former Attorney General of Oklahoma, who spent most of his time as Attorney General suing the EPA to try to prevent them from regulating carbon emissions, and spent much of his time ghostwriting policy papers that had actually been written by fossil fuel interests, who, again, fund his campaigns. So the fact that someone like Scott Pruitt, who spent his time as Attorney General of Oklahoma attacking the EPA and attacking efforts to deal with climate change, is now heading up the EPA, is a very clear indication of how the foxes are now guarding the hen house when it comes to environmental regulation. Look at his Department of Energy Secretary, Rick Perry, who is also a climate change denier. If you look at many of the other individuals who have been appointed to cabinet-level positions or high-level positions within various government administrations, and it's like a who's who of Koch brothers affiliates. And it's very clear that the Koch brothers, the largest privately held fossil fuel interest and major funders of the public relations campaign to deny and attack the science of climate change, they have a level of influence now within the Trump administration unlike anything we've ever seen before. And, of course, we have willing accomplices when it comes to congressional Republicans. It seems like the one thing they've actually been able to agree upon, the administration and congressional Republicans, is their agenda of dismantling environmental protections. And even as other aspects of Trump's agenda have run into roadblocks, that effort to dismantle environmental protections is proceeding with remarkable pace, and it's very worrying.
Yeah, it looks like they're going into a lot of detail. They just find the word climate anywhere and fire everybody around it. So at their recent meeting in Italy, the United States prevented a joint statement by the G7 group of wealthy economies to endorse the Paris Climate Agreement. Is that serious?
Yeah, of course it is, because this is how this necrotizing infection spreads, right? The Trump administration, well, they have, some degree of control over our own climate policies and energy policies, but there's only so much damage that they can do through changing our policies alone. After all, we're just one country. We're responsible for somewhere in the range of 4 to 5% of global carbon emissions. That's not trivial, but obviously progress can still be made as long as everybody else is on board, as long as all the other countries, the other G7 nations are on board, and the nearly 200 nations around the world who have committed to the Paris Accord to make dramatic cuts in carbon emissions. So Where the infection spreads and becomes dangerous is in the efforts by the Trump administration to, in essence, hijack multinational efforts to do something about the problem, to throw a monkey wrench into the works. You know, when it comes, for example, to this latest effort, of all the other G7 nations, all the other industrial nations were ready to sign on to a fairly forward-looking, proactive statement about the urgency of acting on climate. And the sole holdout was the United States. They refused to sign on to the statement, and that meant that ultimately a consensus statement of the G7 nations could not be issued. And so that's where the Trump administration is starting to impact larger global efforts to do something about this problem. If the U.S., for example, if Trump makes good on his threat to withdraw from the Paris Accord, well, then that potentially could damage the rather fragile agreement reached, again, by nearly 200 nations operating in good faith to find common ground in how we're going to go about this transition away from fossil fuels toward renewable energy and avoid catastrophic climate change. When one of the world's two largest emitters, which is the U.S., China is currently the largest emitter. When one of the world's largest emitters unilaterally withdraws from the agreement, that, of course, provides cover, right, for other countries to say, well, hey, if the U.S. is pulling out, then why should we do this? Fortunately, thus far, even in the face of Trump and his administration's intransigence, China, who's the largest emitter, as I mentioned earlier, has remained steadfast. They've said that they are still going to make good on their commitments, and in fact, they are even exceeding their commitments when you look at the fact that they're now decommissioning coal-fired power plants and investing much more in renewable energy than any other nation in the world. So one can still look to, a country like China for optimism that perhaps the agreement will hold. But the real threat here is that this cancer spreads, that the Trump administration's very backward-looking policies on energy and climate begin to infect larger global efforts and agreements to act. That's where the real threat is. And with this latest action at the G7 summit, that's an indication that, again, that the infection, the cancer, is beginning to spread.
In Time magazine, April 8th, you wrote about the single shining hope to stop climate change. What is that hope?
Well, the hope is that, in short, the world is ready to move on, right? Fossil fuels are an antiquated technology. Just as we moved away from whale oil in the 19th century because it just no longer made sense, the same thing is now true of fossil fuels. And we're seeing a remarkable trend when you look at the price for renewable energy, solar, wind, geothermal, et cetera. We're seeing these sort of economies of scale and efficiencies that are now causing these alternative sources of energy to be competitive with fossil fuel energy sooner than we thought that would be. And that's even without any agreed upon price on carbon. So even in a playing field that's not yet even, because after all, fossil fuel, the burning of fossil fuels is doing damage to the planet, and there should be a cost with a price on carbon. And if there were to be a price on carbon, then renewable energy would be even more competitive. But even without that price on carbon, we're seeing huge increases in efficiency and in market share of renewable energy. And that's where the world's headed. It's pretty clear. And ultimately, the real question now is whether the U.S. is going to get on board with what I would characterize as the greatest revolution of the last century, the renewable energy revolution, whether we're going to get on board or we're going to get left behind as the rest of the world does move ahead. So that's the good news. There's no question that transition is underway and it's unstoppable. The problem is that it has to happen even faster than the current trajectory that we're on if we are going to avoid burning enough carbon to lock in dangerous and potentially catastrophic impacts on our climate.
Good. Well, tell us about the Scientist March on April 22nd.
Yeah, so this is, it's sort of this organic effort that sprung up from the scientific community. I think there's a collective feeling among scientists in this country that science is under assault right now in a way that we've never seen before, certainly climate science, where Trump is doing everything he can to defund the science, and Congress is actually engaging in witch hunts, attacking climate scientists like the one I testified at a couple weeks ago. The attacks on the science continue, and they're escalating, and it isn't just climate science. You know, Trump administration wants to cut the National Institutes for Health by a fairly healthy percent. I forget the exact percent, but a fairly sizable cut in their budget. And really across the board, we're seeing an effort to defund science, or at least any science that doesn't have immediate sort of corporate spin-offs, any science that doesn't directly, you know, aid vested interests. Pure science and science aimed at the public good, whether it's health, the health of people in the form of the National Institutes for Health and medical research they support, or, you know, climate research, which is ultimately about the health of our entire planet, and any other environmental research, you know, with huge cuts to the EPA, with cuts to NOAA and NASA, there's an effort to defund that science. But more than that, there is this sort of rejection of really the Enlightenment, the teachings. There's a rejection almost of the tradition of science to aim to ask questions and provide objective answers. That is a threat to vested interests who don't like the answers, who don't like what scientists are finding, whether it's stem cell research or evolution or climate change or any number of topics. And that's why I think you're seeing this groundswell of support. Scientists of all stripes, young, old, from all different fields, coming together and deciding, you know, as much as scientists would prefer to spend their time doing science, and I can tell you as a scientist, you know, I'd be perfectly happy just left alone in my lab, doing calculations, working with my students, trying to advance our knowledge and teaching the next generation of scientists. That's what scientists prefer to spend their time doing. But when science is under an assault like the current one that we're witnessing, ultimately, scientists will come out and will speak up. And that's why you're going to see, you know, something that at least in my lifetime is unprecedented, scientists literally marching in the streets of Washington, D.C., and I understand that there'll be satellite marches all around the country in protest of this, the current political atmosphere, the current anti-science political atmosphere. I think that scientists' voices will be heard on April 22nd.
This is Radio EcoShock. My guest is Dr. Michael Mann, the Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State University. Now we're going to try and squeeze in a little bit of talk about the real climate science that affects you directly. Dr. Mann is the lead author of an article published March 27th in the journal Nature. The title is Influence of Anthropogenic Climate Change on Planetary Wave Resonance and Extreme Weather Events. Michael, what is the central question you and your authors addressed?
Thanks. It's quite a mouthful, isn't it? And yeah, that's the title is sort of loaded with fairly scientific, with fairly jargonish sort of science speak. But ultimately, what we were looking at was actually not that complicated. What we're asking is climate change changing the behavior of the jet stream in a way that may lead to this phenomenon we've seen so much of in recent years. A lot of the extreme weather events that we've seen, the major droughts and wildfires and floods and heat waves, particularly in the spring, summer, and early fall during that part of the year, many of those extreme and persistent weather disturbances have been associated with a particular type of behavior where the jet stream gets extremely wavy. So, you know, the jet stream, you know, undulates as it crosses the country, and where it heads north, you get what's called a ridge, and then where it comes back south, you get a trough, and it carries weather systems along with it. And the larger those ridges and troughs, the more pronounced the regional weather impacts are going to be. So when you have a very large sort of waviness in the jet stream, and especially if the jet stream essentially gets stuck so that those peaks and troughs remain in the same place for day after day, that's where you get these extreme prolonged weather anomalies, like the 2010 California wildfires, the 2011 Oklahoma and Texas drought and heat wave, the 2003 European heat wave, the 2010 Russian wildfires, and the huge flooding that they had at the same time in Pakistan. All of those were associated with that type of behavior of the jet stream. What our latest study shows, using climate models and observations, is that the pattern that favors that configuration of the jet stream is becoming more prevalent over time. And using the climate models, we're able to show that that is a result of human-caused warming of the planet. And without going too much into the details, it has to do with the fact that the polar regions are warming faster, the Arctic is warming even faster than the rest of the world because of the melting ice, and that accelerates the warming. You get even more warming in the Arctic than you get down here in middle latitudes. And that change in the pattern of warming as you go north-south actually influences the jet stream. And it turns out it influences the jet stream in a way that makes that particular pattern that we're talking about more prevalent. So we do think now that there's a fairly clear connection between human-caused warming of the planet and the increased incidence of some of these unprecedented weather extremes that we've seen in recent years.
Is the science getting closer to helping meteorologists predict extreme weather events so we could get more public warning or maybe governments could prepare better?
Yeah, it's a great question. And while we haven't looked at, you know, how this particular method could be operationalized, we have every reason to believe that it could. The conditions that we're talking about are indeed predictable in some sense, in sort of the near term. You can see them coming, you know, a week in advance potentially. And so, yes, there could be some applications of the same research to improved forecasting of extreme weather events, and that's something that we as a group are pursuing. We're also now looking not just at the historical changes, but now looking into the future using climate model simulations, projections of the future. How likely are we to see further increases in incidence of these types of conditions as the warming proceeds? So stay tuned. We hope to have answers to those questions in the near future.
The late American scientist Stephen Schneider wrote the book Science is a Contact Sport, and looking at your recent years, Michael, the attacks, your work, the appearances, all your appearances, maybe you should have written that, but please tell us about your most recent book and any updated editions that you may have for us.
Thanks. Yeah, so I've written a few books now, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, back in 2012, which is about my experiences sort of in the crosshairs of climate change denialism and my tangles with politicians, climate change denying politicians, and 2008, and then we revised it for the latest IPCC report, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, in 2012, Dire Predictions, Understanding Climate Change, which is a fairly straight-up but graphics and picture sort of driven review of the entire science, the physical science behind climate change, the projected impacts, and the solutions, what we can do about the problem. Then most recently now, back this fall, September, in fact, I published a book co-authored with Tom Tolles, who is the cartoonist, the editorial cartoonist for the Washington Post. And Tom has done lots of cartoons about climate change and climate change denial in particular, and the hypocrisy of climate change denying politicians over the years. And we decided to combine forces and write a book that sort of uses his cartoons to tell, again, the story of the science, the impacts, the politics, and sort of looking forward to the solutions. It's sort of interesting. This fall, when we published the book, many of our colleagues sort of said, well, you know, why are you guys writing a book about climate change denial? Aren't we past all of that now? We're ready to move on. And, of course, then we had the election. And history had another viewpoint. And, you know, with the election of Donald Trump, we now have, you know, a chief executive who is a climate change denier and is using his power to enforce a policy, a governmental policy of climate change denial. So we are very much back in the madhouse. And, you know, I think the book now has this salience or even prescient feeling because, indeed, it's far more relevant now than we possibly could have imagined when we published this book back in September. Ultimately, we try to take sort of a lighthearted approach, using humor and satire, and, you know, ridicule where appropriate, you know, to talk about the issue, but in a different way, and maybe get some people who thus far have tuned out. Maybe we can get their interest with this sort of comic, satirical approach to the issue of climate change.
Well, I'd say maybe Donald Trump should read your book, but he probably doesn't read books, but I'm sure he could get the cartoons.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I've been a fan of climate progress blogger Joe Rome for years. He just wrote, "Global warming will defrost much more permafrost than we thought." A new study finds every 1 degree C, or 1.8 degree Fahrenheit, of additional warming would thaw one quarter of the Earth's frozen tundra area, releasing staggering amounts of heat-trapping greenhouse gases, end quote. Hold that thought. The implications of new research published April 10th are deep and very serious, but it took years of work to find the real measure of thawing permafrost. I've reached the lead author of that study. Dr. Sarah E. Chadburn is a postdoctoral research fellow in the United Kingdom at the University of Leeds. Sarah Chadburn, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi.
How do we know that permafrost is thawing faster over larger areas in the last couple of decades?
So in the last few decades, we've seen a lot of warming in the Arctic. And in terms of permafrost, it's actually quite difficult to measure what's happening on a large scale because it tends to be deep under the ground and we can't measure it from satellites. But what we do have are smaller scale studies where people have gone out and measured the permafrost, and they've found in a lot of cases the permafrost is either warming up or it's thawing, or the thawing is accelerating.
Well, let's picture that the fossil fuel magnates conquer politics as they appear to have done in the United States. We don't act in time, and the world warms at least 2 degrees by the year 2100. What happens to the permafrost?
So first of all, if we stayed with this kind of business-as-usual scenario, and actually we're going to see a lot more than 2 degrees of warming by 2100. In fact, we could see up to 5 degrees, and we looked at this in our study, and under 5 degrees of warming, we would lose almost all of the permafrost. But if we do, if we manage to keep under 2 degrees of warming, which is the upper limit on the Paris Agreement, then we would still lose quite a lot of the permafrost. In fact, more than 40% of it would thaw.
And when you say we could lose all of the permafrost, I presume that you're not meaning by 2100, but that it would happen over the following centuries, or can it happen very quickly?
So in some areas, it can thaw very quickly. It would take maybe a couple of decades. But then in other areas, it could take 100 years or more to thaw.
Well, what if we managed to hold warming to 1.5 degrees C, just half a degree less than the 2-degree alleged safety limit? How much permafrost could we save?
So in that case, we would save around 2 million square kilometers of permafrost.
Then why should we try to save the permafrost? Won't it all melt anyway, sooner or later?
Well, first of all, if we manage to stabilize the climate at 1.5 or 2 degrees or something around there, then, in fact, more than half of the permafrost is not going to thaw, and it's going to be preserved. The permafrost is important globally, as I expect we'll discuss later on, but it's also important in itself because of the ecosystems that are there and the animals and plants and people that live there.
Well, right. I'm hearing two streams of worry from scientists and people in the north. The first is about clogging northern rivers and coastlines with thawed muck from these ages past, and the whole landscape can sag or rise or become very unstable. Can we say global warming is driving geologic scale change in the north all around the world?
Yeah, we can. So I said earlier that we can't really directly measure permafrost from a satellite because it's deep under the ground, but we can measure these kind of geologic changes that are associated with permafrost thaw. So there was a paper in 2005 where they looked at satellite images and they showed that as the permafrost starts to thaw, there's these new lakes that are forming, which can be seen from space, and then as it thaws even more, then the lakes start to drain and disappear. So you really do have big changes.
And the second concern, of course, is about more greenhouse gases flowing out of the permafrost. What are the pathways and the gases released as land thaws?
So yeah, exactly. That's a big concern. So the main two greenhouse gases that you expect from permafrost thaw are carbon dioxide and methane. And these, which one is released, depends really on the hydrology. So that's how wet the ground is. So if the ground is very wet, you get methane. And if it's drier, then you get carbon dioxide emitted. These gases, actually, they're not stored in the ground as gases. They're either stored in organic matter. So that's like the remains of dead plants and animals, which are frozen into the ground. So it's like if you put some food in the freezer or something, it doesn't rot. When the permafrost thaws, then it starts to rot and it decomposes and turns into these greenhouse gases. And then there's also these things called methane hydrates, which are kind of a scary thing because they can be released very, very quickly from the ground, and that releases methane.
Okay, so there's methane hydrates in the ground as well. I've read about them in the ocean on the sea bottom. It's like sort of a formation of ice and methane all mixed together. I didn't know that they were also in the land.
Yeah, there is some on land, so that's not really my speciality, but I'm certainly aware that there is some.
Now, can greenhouse gases from thawing permafrost become a positive feedback loop where more creates more? And if that's true, could you describe how it might work?
Yeah, I think it's quite simple, really. So once you have these greenhouse gases released, then those add to global warming, like through the greenhouse effect. And this can cause more permafrost to thaw, which can then lead to more emissions of gases, and then this is an amplifying effect. We call it, yeah, like you said, a positive feedback. And there's actually a lot of different feedbacks in the climate system, and some of them are positive, which means they amplify the warming, and some of them damp the warming. And this is one of the positive climate feedbacks.
Well, getting back to senior climate blogger Joe Rome, he also said, quote, "One study found that the feedback from just the CO2 released by the thawing permafrost alone could add 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit to total global warming by 2100 if we don't sharply curtail carbon pollution as soon as possible." Well, we've already added almost 1.5 degrees already. Of course, that's centigrade. It sounds like permafrost decay alone could equal or exceed all human emissions to date. That's hard to believe. Let's get some discussion going. Is that possible?
So I guess it is possible, but I would say it's pretty unlikely from what we understand so far. Basically, there's a lot of uncertainty in how much of the carbon in the permafrost would be emitted if it thawed. Now, there's a lot of carbon in there. We could end up with that amount of carbon emitted to the atmosphere, but it's actually very unlikely from our modeling studies. So far, we're seeing that maybe an extra like few tenths of a degree of warming by 2100 from the permafrost carbon.
Now, when we hear astounding facts like these, though, it's only human to ask, how do you know? So let's work on that. You've been working for years to reconcile the results of large-scale computer models to actual measurements taken across the Arctic. Why do we need a good model for what is happening with the permafrost?
Well, first of all, like I said, it's hard to actually observe the permafrost on a large scale, so it's useful to be able to model it. And then more importantly, we need to understand what's going to happen with it in the future. So that's these carbon releases that we're talking about and the impacts on the land surface. And the only way to really find out what will happen in the future is to model it.
Sarah Chadburn, your earlier work was on the Jules Land Surface Model. What is that?
So that's a model I still work with a lot. It's actually part of the climate model we have in the UK. So the model basically represents the whole Earth, and it's called an Earth system model. You can probably appreciate it's pretty complex, but it's separated into three parts. And there's the atmosphere part, the ocean part, and the land part, and Jules is actually the land part of that model.
Well, even though it's run by the UK Met Office, it's available to other researchers without a fee. Do you think this adds more possibilities for collaborative research?
Yeah, definitely. And we've seen, so the model has benefited a lot from the input from the scientific community to developing the model and improving it. And then as scientific users outside of the Met Office, we also benefit from the technical support that they have there. So it seems to be a win-win situation.
And your new paper that we're discussing, is it based completely on modeling, or did your team cross-check against developments in various northern countries?
In fact, one of the main things that made our approach stand out from other previous approaches is that we relied much more on observations rather than just using a model. So we actually used the observations to construct our model in the first place, and then we used more observations to cross-check what we were getting out of it. So we basically used as many observations as we could find.
And is it true that the warming estimates in the latest reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change do not include any warming due to permafrost thawing?
This is basically right. So the models that they included in the IPCC report, none of the climate models had this permafrost carbon represented. But in the report, they do talk about the permafrost carbon and how much potential warming that could add.
All right. Now, what does your new paper say to other climate modelers?
I think the fact that we could reduce the uncertainty on the permafrost thaw using a really simple approach like we've used means that the permafrost really needs to be better represented in the climate models.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest from the University of Leeds is Sarah E. Chadburn. We're talking about how thawing permafrost could radically change the world you live in. Permafrost research is going on all around the world. It's fascinating stuff. One study by Canadian scientists showed the thaw is revealing the outlines of an ancient glacier. Sarah, do you think the subsoil has a memory?
Well, there's very long timescales involved in the soil, so in a sense, yes. There's things that are in there, have been in there for thousands of years. Like, you can dig down into the permafrost and find whole roots and pieces of plants that have been there since thousands of years ago, and they're still in the soil.
And in the popular press and alternative blogs that I look at, we see a lot of sudden eruptions in Siberia, likely caused by methane. And we get photos of millions of small round lakes appearing pretty suddenly across the Siberian bogs. I think people don't realize almost a quarter of the Northern Hemisphere is still frozen. We certainly have a lot of it in Northern Canada. And we're worried about this possible mass release of carbon dioxide and methane, as we talked about. But I ran across a scientist who reportedly reduces that concern. Suzanne Tank is a scientist at the University of Alberta in Canada. She told a reporter from Inside Climate News that the majority of carbon from the Canadian thaw is released as coarse particles that don't convert to CO2 right away. Should we worry less because of that?
So I don't think we should. I mean, we already know that we don't expect it to be immediate release of greenhouse gases, but we expect it to occur over the next century or so. So yes, it's a slow process. But then there are some aspects that can be faster, like this methane release that I mentioned.
Well, given the very rapid warming of the Arctic, I'd like to see some sort of multinational war room for models and observations and a database of solutions, a central international authority or something. At least ways for humans and other creatures to adapt could be in there as well. Given the threat, do you think we are doing enough?
So in terms of what's being done on the ground in terms of adaptation in the Arctic, I'm not really sure what's going on there. In terms of actually reducing the warming to kind of mitigate any of these things happening in the first place, we have this Paris Agreement and we have commitments from the different countries, and the current commitments won't limit the warming to 2 degrees. It's going to be higher, so we still need more to be done.
At the annual meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science in Vancouver 2012, I recorded a workshop of permafrost scientists, and one older Canadian scientist who's well known in the field for his decades of patient measurements, he still felt the science of permafrost would not be relevant or popular until later this century. It's a very slow process, he said. Now, just 5 years later, what do you think?
Well, certainly a lot of people are aware of it and aware of the issues now. But I think saying that it's not relevant now, even if it is a slow process, and some of the processes, carbon release will definitely be slow, we're laying the foundations for that future carbon release now, because the permafrost is thawing now, and then it's then irreversible. Once the permafrost is thawed, then the carbon is eventually, it's going to decompose and come out to the atmosphere. But also, we don't, because there is quite a lot of uncertainty about this process, we don't have a good grasp of what the timescale is going to be. Is it going to be a century? Is there going to be some really immediate effects? I think that is something we should be concerned about. And again, even if something's not relevant to the end of the century, it's something that we should still think about, because we should maybe be concerned for future generations.
Just maybe.
Yeah.
It's hard for us to imagine what's happening in this formerly permanently frozen lands of the north. We thought it was permanent, unless you've been there anyway. And the maps are huge. The calculations are huge. Maybe this whole process is still beyond our grasp. Your thoughts?
So I think we're starting to understand it certainly much better than we did. It would really help. So one of the main problems is that it's hard to get observations of permafrost, and there's not any kind of consistent funding for people to do that. And a lot of the other climate variables, like air temperature, for example, those are monitored by government programs that are continuous, whereas there's no kind of continuous government program for permafrost monitoring. So that's something that would be really useful.
Yeah, I think the government in Alaska has some program for monitoring, and Canada does little bits and bats, but you're totally right. I haven't seen sort of an international sustained program to measure permafrost and what's happening.
Yeah, I think that's what we need.
Well, when I look through your past, I see a pretty steady and determined course to refine the tools we need to wrestle with this big problem. What's next for you, Sarah?
So in this recent work, we've been looking at the kind of physical state of the permafrost. But now in the next few years, hopefully, I'm going to be focusing on the carbon side of this. So how much greenhouse gases might be released.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about or tell our listeners?
I guess I'd like to say thanks to everyone for taking an interest. We've had really a lot of people interested in this study, which is great in terms of raising awareness and inspiring people. So, yeah, thanks.
We've been speaking with Sarah E. Chadburn. In the UK, she's a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Leeds School of Earth and Environment. She's also the lead author of a new paper published April 10th, 2017, in the journal Nature. The title is An Observation-Based Constraint on Permafrost Loss as a Function of Global Warming. You can find links to all the science we've discussed in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Sarah, thank you so much for helping us out.
Thanks, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
Food can be about security, guilt, pleasure, climate, the future we choose, or who we are. And just when we know the green goal of food correctness, I get this headbender in the mail, The Vegetarian's Guide to Eating Meat, A Young Woman's Search for Ethical Food. The author is Professor Marissa Landrigan. She's an engaging American writer whose essays appear in The Atlantic, Salon, Guernica, and Orion magazines. From the University of Pittsburgh, Marissa, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me, Alex.
Are you a foodie?
I think I am a foodie, though to be honest, I cringe a little bit at that term. Foodie sounds to me so elitist, and the truth is that the food choices that I make are ones that I hope become easy and accessible for a lot of people to make.
Well, you're at least a generation younger than I am, but we both grew up in the suburbs knowing food came from the supermarket, of course. We didn't really learn to cook for ourselves, maybe didn't have to. And I'll bet that describes a lot of people, maybe most people, in the Western-style world, at least at a younger age. How does that happen?
It's really a striking thing, and what's especially surprising about it to me is that I grew up in a family where food was really important, and in fact, we spent a lot of time cooking. My mother's side of the family is Italian-American. They made their own pasta. We had these day-long cooking fests, but we still largely shopped at grocery stores, bulk stores, and I managed to make it till I was in college, I think, before I actually had a really good look at what a modern American industrial farm looked like.
And you chose vegetarianism at what age and why?
I was about 20 when I decided to become a vegetarian. It was my second year at college, and it was because I saw a PETA video, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I saw what a factory farm looked like for the first time. I saw how animals were kept and raised, and I saw how they were slaughtered, and it horrified me. And I thought that the only way to avoid participating in such an unethical, immoral system was to boycott meat consumption completely.
And that was in Ithaca, New York, where we've been broadcasting for quite a few years.
Yes, that's right. Ithaca was, I have to be honest, a wonderful place to become a vegetarian. Though I ate my first vegetarian meals in the dining hall, Ithaca College in particular has a pretty welcoming attitude about other dietary choices.
Well, one phrase from your book echoes in my mind because it applies to so many things. You write about an enormous amount of suffering that happened behind closed doors. What does that mean to you now?
Well, what it means to me now is to remember how much of that suffering that sort of remains behind closed doors applies to many different sort of forms of diets, basically. Well, initially, I was shocked to discover the suffering that animals underwent in this sort of industrial agriculture system. But over the course of my time as a vegetarian and since then, I've discovered a lot of other closed doors and a lot of other sources of suffering. For example, the rather horrifying conditions that many undocumented migrant farm workers live and work in. The fact that farming is the third most dangerous job in the United States, and that farmers have higher rates of cancer and toxic chemical poisoning than any other industry. Now, that to me is an enormous kind of suffering, and it's one that can be applied to either a vegetarian or an omnivorous diet. Vegetarians eat produce. A lot of that produce is sprayed with pesticides, and unfortunately, that pesticide use works back on the migrant workers.
But wait a minute, I want to think about myself as pure when I eat my veggies.
Right, exactly. And I think the problem is that we've spent too much time establishing this binary where vegetarian diets are always good and meat-based diets are always ethically inferior to vegetarian diets. And I think the real picture is a little bit more complicated than that. The truth is that many of our dietary choices contribute to some form of suffering, and there is such a thing as an ethical diet that includes meat and an unethical diet that is largely vegetarian.
Well, yeah, you write about, as a 20-something in Washington, D.C., working for the Wilderness Society, your vegetarian diet was actually pretty awful. Tell us about that.
Yes, I was not a very good vegetarian, especially in my early years. I had went from the dining hall to learning to cook on my own, and I had never cooked a vegetarian meal in my life before. So I sort of stuck to the center aisles of the grocery store where mostly the food is processed, pre-prepared, packaged with lots of additives and preservatives. And I wasn't really experimenting with new ways of thinking about cooking and eating food, new meals that really centered on whole foods and produce. And I was instead sort of sticking to what is actually a fairly traditional American diet, just one that didn't happen to include meat.
How did your vegetarianism go over when you moved to Bozeman, Montana?
Oh, that was a tough transition, though again, I think a lot of the difficulty there was one that I was sort of imposing myself. Bozeman, Montana is a beautiful place and has a long legacy of cattle ranching. Of course, also has a long legacy of hunting. And as a vegetarian, I thought that hunting was something that, again, I should just automatically abhor and be opposed to because it was the death and suffering of an animal. And so that made me immediately very alienated from a lot of the people of Bozeman who were, in fact, probably eating a much more close to the source local diet than I was as a vegetarian. So again, by falling back on that binary where I assumed by not eating meat I was sort of morally superior, I ignored a system of food that involved some hunting, but hunting in a way that was really sort of sustainable as part of the ecosystem.
Then you arrive in California, the land of food plenty, only to discover that, quote, 47% of adults in Ventura County live in food insecure households. How is that possible?
food insecurity is a huge issue in this country and really globally. One of the things that I think is so important to acknowledge when it comes to these closed doors of suffering is the number of people on this planet who don't have access to enough food, period. So when we have questions about whether small-scale sustainable farming, for instance, can successfully feed the world, the first thing that I always think is, well, we're not currently feeding the world. Industrial agriculture leaves a lot of people out in the cold. It has a lot of waste inherent in the system, and lots of people still go hungry.
So how did Michael Pollan and his book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, change your life?
Well, I had a funny thing happen when I read The Omnivore's Dilemma. I happened at the time to live in Ames, Iowa, which is where one of the very first scenes in the book takes place. So he was literally writing about my backyard at the time, and specifically he was writing about the corn-soy monoculture of most of the American Midwest and the farming landscape there, and how it contributed to the industrial production of meat. And it got me thinking about the ways in which the industrial agriculture system went beyond just a system of livestock production, that it was also a system of producing vegetables and produce and other forms of food that I was eating as a vegetarian. And so it was really the thing that started to complicate the picture for me a little bit, that first made me think maybe there's another path. Maybe there's a third way, something in between vegetarianism and meat eating, and something that focuses more on the method of production rather than on necessarily the end product of that production in the form of the meal itself.
Interesting. So Marissa Landrigan, talk to us about the corporate connections to the organic food industry. And is there anything wrong with that?
Well, I think that in general, the fact that more and more corporations are producing organic food does say something positive about the market, right? The demand for organic food is going up, and these corporations are recognizing that. I think that is certainly a positive. I think the problem comes when people assume, again, that by buying vegetarian food or organic food, they are automatically buying into an ethical system, when that may not necessarily be the case, unfortunately. For example, the Kraft Heinz corporate conglomerate, which is now a single company, owns and produces the Oscar Mayer brand of meat products, one that many of us would consider to be pretty low on the totem pole in terms of healthy and sustainable meat production, right? Bacon, hot dogs, all that. Kraft Heinz also owns and produces Morningstar and Garden Burger, two of the most popular brands of vegetarian meat substitute products. And so whether you're buying Oscar Mayer or you're buying a Garden Burger, your food dollars are ending up in the same hands. That, I think, is a problem. So I'm all for corporations getting in the organic game because, as I said, I think it results from an increased demand in organic. But I want consumers to be aware of where they're really spending their money. And I think they might be better off spending that money at a local farm, whether it's organic, whether it grows meat or not, than by spending it and giving it back to the same company that's going to produce the Oscar Mayer wieners.
Okay, well, on that topic, just between you and me, is the McDonald's vegetarian burger a good choice?
Well, I think it all depends on what you mean by good, Alex. It's probably the best available choice there, and sometimes you've got to go with the best available choice. Although I do have to say I have had it, and in terms of taste, it is not necessarily what I would call a good choice. I would rather pack myself some granola bars before I take the road trip and have to settle for the McDonald's veggie burger.
You do use two words that don't fit well together, humane slaughter. Those aren't pretty words, are they? But you're looking at that, aren't you?
That's right. I think that's really the key to it. We don't like to look at some of the suffering that's inherent in our food system. But the truth is that eating as a human is almost always going to contribute to some form of suffering, human suffering, animal suffering. And there's very little that we can do, I believe, to completely 100% of the time avoid contributing to or causing that suffering. So for me, it's really about how can we minimize that suffering? What can we do to reduce the harm that we cause? And I think part of that has to come in the form of opening our eyes up to it and acknowledging that suffering has to be a part of a food system in some ways and in some places. I think it's not until we acknowledge that that we can really do anything to minimize the harm. And some of the most humane treatment of animals that I've seen has happened inside a slaughterhouse where all of the people involved in killing and processing the animal were very aware of what they were doing, very mindful of it, and therefore took it quite seriously and really ritualized it to the point where it felt like a ritual of respect and an understanding of the sacrifice.
And your book isn't a lecture. It's really a story, and a story about your life. It's very personal. And your travels for work and education and love took you to places you never thought you'd be, like Iowa and then Kansas. Looking back, I want to ask, did that part of your life make sense, or do we weave a sensible story to fit anything that happens?
I think that it's a little bit of both, really. I mean, it all made sense at the time. Every step I took, I thought, sure, why not? This is the next logical step to take. But I absolutely think that some of it is sort of retrospectively now weaving some sense of narrative and meaning out of that wandering. Now, from the other side of it all, I can see the ways in which each of those places really had an impact on me, and the way that I saw the ideas of food and home and land and community. But I think at the time, it was much more short-sighted, much more direct. But I'm really glad to hear that it does feel more like a story than a lecture, Alex, because that was really my goal, is to tell my story and to sort of detail the process, because it was a long and winding and meandering and wandering process that, yeah, sometimes didn't make sense, but now has sort of gotten me to a place where I feel really sort of stable and secure in the food choices that I make. And so my hope was really that by simply sharing my own story, I might be able to help other people figure out their own path rather than just dictate a path for them.
But we do have studies showing that eating a lot of red meat can lead to heart disease and cancer. What are your thoughts?
Yes, absolutely. I don't have any problem with suggesting that Americans in particular, but people in developed countries in general, should eat significantly less meat, and less red meat specifically. There are two things that I would say, however. The first is that it's important to recognize that not all meat is created equal, that many of these studies suggest that meat that is raised on a grass-based diet rather than a corn or soy diet doesn't have as significantly negative a health impact on the eater as meat that is industrially raised or produced. But I think that in general, a healthier diet is one that involves less meat. Right now, most Americans eat much, much more protein than their bodies actually need, and most of it comes from red meat sources in particular. And we're going to need to cut back on that to be healthier for our own bodies, but also to have less of an impact on the land, because red meat contributes most significantly to global warming as a result of agriculture. And so I think that we'll need to reduce the amount of meat that we eat overall, and we'll also need to change the way that we raise that meat.
You know, it's so complex because, on the other hand, I have listeners who follow the work of Alan Savory, and he showed that great herds of animals properly managed can put lots of carbon back into the soil, and that could be important to reducing climate change. Have you encountered that argument for eating red meat?
Yes, absolutely. And for many, many things, for many ways where livestock can actually be a really sustainable and helpful part of an ecosystem. I think that this is one of the reasons why what we really need to do is find a way to focus on localized food economies, because each location is going to have a different set of needs and a different set of logical inputs to make the most out of the resources that are available in that particular location. And some of those locations, it will make sense to incorporate animals. For instance, one thing that a lot of people have been reading about and discussing lately is the possible negative impacts on the South American food system of the increased demand for quinoa as it becomes a more popular food staple for people in developed countries. And one of the side effects that we've seen in South America is that more and more farmers are reducing the size of their llama populations that they're raising because they're devoting more and more of their land to the growth of quinoa and less of it to grazing llamas. Producing fewer llamas means that they also produce less fertilizer in the form of manure, which means that they're having to turn to synthetic fertilizers to grow more quinoa. So the absence of a livestock animal from that food system is actually going to have a negative impact on the environment and on the productivity of that food system.
You talked about localizing your food sources. Have you been able to find ways to do that in the Pittsburgh area?
I have. I'm very, very lucky that the Pittsburgh area has a really great food system in place, and in particular, a restaurant scene that places a really high premium on locally sourced food. So I'm also very lucky that I get to go out to eat and know where my food is coming from quite often as well. There are lots of farmers markets in the area, as well as many, many farms that run CSAs or community supported agriculture programs. There are farm stands, and there are lots of even just locally owned butcher shops and grocers, and I find that they can often sort of point me in the right direction when it comes to other sources of food.
Marissa, have you encountered any pushback to this new work, perhaps from people who still hold the idealism that you've changed?
Yes, absolutely. I think that probably the pushback that I get the most is from people who are still fundamentally made uncomfortable at the idea that an animal will die for them to eat. And I can understand that. I think there is a way to eat a diet that is ethical and sustainable and primarily vegetarian. And if that's the diet that someone feels most individually ethically comfortable with, I think that's perfectly fine. For me, incorporating meat was, as I said, a way to acknowledge the suffering. And so as long as anyone who wants to remain vegetarian or vegan finds a way to acknowledge the suffering that even that diet includes and finds a way to face it and work to minimize it, then I think we are fundamentally on the same page.
As we wrap up, this book of your life with food sounds like an unfinished journey. Do you have any idea where it goes next?
It will be really interesting to see. I find that from where I am now, really, I think I've figured out a pretty good system in terms of being flexible and forgiving when and how I need to be, but generally adhering to these sort of basic principles. The next step will be really interesting to see how things change is as my family grows. The book just barely mentions that I've recently gotten married, and my husband and I hope to start a family and have children soon, and I have absolutely no idea what it will take to feed a family of more than two. So it will be interesting to see how and whether I can sort of keep up with this kind of ethical shopping and cooking when there are other mouths to feed.
And you'll discover those other mouths have choices of their own, even
exactly.
At a young age. I don't eat that. Don't give me that. Okay. We've been talking with American author and educator Marissa Landrigan, and her newest work goes against the green stream. It's called The Vegetarian's Guide to Eating Meat from Greystone Books. You can find links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org or check out marissalandrigan.com. Thank you, Marissa. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We're out of time in more ways than one. Don't forget to support the March for Science on Earth Day, April 22nd. Thank you for listening, and please tune in again next week for more Radio EcoShock.
Guest today, Colleen Rowley, had a long and distinguished career with the FBI before retiring in 2004 after serving 24 years in a variety of positions, mainly as a special agent, which provided her with an unusual insight into the workings as well as failures of the intelligence community. In 2002, she testified to the Senate and 9/11 Commission about the FBI's pre-9/11 lapses due to its internal organization and mishandling of information related to the attacks, which led to her sharing Time Magazine's Person of the Year Award with two other women whistleblowers. In February 2003, she warned her superiors, quote, that the Bureau was not prepared to deal with new terrorist strikes that she and many colleagues fear would result from an American war with Iraq, end quote. Rowley has been a regular contributor at the Huffington Post since January 2006, as well as writing for The Guardian, and authored a chapter in Patriotism, Democracy, and Common Sense, Restoring America's Promise at Home and Abroad, published by Roman and Littlefield in 2005. She is also a member of the Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPS, whose memorandum to President Trump regarding the crisis over Syria I referred to earlier in the program. Welcome again to Takes on the World, Colleen Rowley.
Thanks for having me. Well, I also wrote a chapter in the book, Why Peace?
Well, you have a remarkable career. We last spoke to you in 2014 about the role that the neocons have been setting up for U.S. foreign policy following 9/11. And with the attack on Syria and the anti-Russian hysteria that has gripped liberal media, it seems like they're back in control.
Absolutely. We now have this unholy alliance between the neocon war hawks, which under the Bush administration were largely on the Republican side, with the so-called conservative side. But what's happened is this sea change now, and this began to happen even long before the election, where the liberal powers under Hillary Clinton, and Samantha Power, what they call the humanitarian interventionists, or the humanitarian war believers, that you have to have the U.S. plain policeman of the world, and at some point disciplining the countries that don't obey U.S. edicts or whatever, and that's all Samantha Powers. And Madeleine Albright. Madeleine Albright actually began it. And, of course, Hillary Clinton is a disciple of this. So they got the liberals, the power liberals, on the side of the neocon warhawks. Now, some of the neocon warhawks, like John McCain, have actually now become supporters of Hillary Clinton. So, our old party distinctions have just gone up in smoke. In fact, if anything, I'm going to tell you something just amazing, which actually surprised me. But our VIPS memo of yesterday that, for a lot of reason, casting doubt upon the White House intelligence, that's even dignifying it too much. The White House paper saying, which actually is Ivanka Trump saying that she's outraged that, the Syrian government's killing babies and there's no evidence at all for this. But our VIPS memo cast doubt on that and basically gave advice to Trump. That memo that came out yesterday that's published in Consortium News was retweeted by Ann Coulter. Far right, who, of course, supported everything that the Bush administration did. There has been a sea change in that some of the conservatives now are, mad that Trump has gone against his America First pledge and gone against what he criticized Hillary Clinton as being stupid for initiating these so-called regime changes. And a lot of the conservatives believe Trump. And now they are the ones who have been betrayed. It's completely topsy-turvy right now in terms of the political situation. And I think people have a hard time understanding when this happens so suddenly, which is what has happened. But these neocons are just like AIPAC. They have their tentacles in what Obama called the D.C. playbook. He called it the D.C. playbook to make, a euphemistic term. In fact, it's what the pro-Israel hardcore war hawks that have been they control the think tanks, a large, not just one think tank, but they are really in many, many think tanks. And they control both parties, just as the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee does. It's a smart strategy, as opposed to mini lobbying groups that pick one party or the other. It's a smart strategy to control both parties and to control the military-industrial complex through the think tanks.
Well, it's interesting. I just, before I called you, I spoke about the AIPAC conference every year. It's bigger than ever by about 2,000. They even had to, a couple of years ago, to move to a larger convention center. This year, 18,000. And I've been outside of one of those in, a few years back, and it's like a Nuremberg rally. The puffery, the puffed up hubris of these people attending it, because they know they are the power in Washington. And it's interesting when they talk about Russia's interference with our elections, of course, without mentioning anymore what the Democratic National Committee did or what Podesta's emails revealed that the American people had every right to know, but evidently not in their opinion. No country has interfered more in the U.S. election than the government of Israel. Can you imagine 2 years ago when Netanyahu was invited by the former Republican functionary, American citizen turncoat Ron Dermer, to speak to both houses of Congress? Any other president, if it had been Obama, would have put Dermer on the first plane back to Israel.
That's exactly right. Israel is not only the biggest meddler in American politics and in American elections, trying to swing elections or whatever. But they are also the country that is amongst the top, if not the top, country engaged in outright espionage. And this was always the case if FBI documents eventually through FOIA and whatever get released, and sometimes even through whistleblowers. Israel is very successful at conducting this espionage, and the United States knows it, but it's never made public. It's almost never talked about. So these are kind of the softer methods through PR and through controlling different entities and groups and obviously the party apparatus. But then the harder, a little bit harder power thing is through espionage itself, through outright stealing of documents. And we had that one indictment, back a few years ago of a couple of AIPAC officials for having stolen Iran. I think it was documents about, these were military and or intelligence documents about Iran, and they were handed over to AIPAC. So that was an outright espionage. And so any case, you're absolutely right. It's Israel that is the country that is, and other countries, of course. One thing about the Russian, all countries that have the ability, of course, whose country has the superpower and the ability to do this more than any other country, to listen in and surveil United Nations offices. What country is doing that the most? Well, it's the United States. Israel's right up there, too. But the United States, and obviously with some of our Five Eye allies, we share these mechanisms whereby we spy on all other foreign leaders, even Angela Merkel and other Hollande and other European allies that we call allies publicly, but in the truth is we are spying on these leaders. My background in the FBI, I did not work too much on foreign counterintelligence, but I did have some familiarity with it from time to time. I did have some roles that involved foreign counterintelligence, and I did read the cables that are. That even back then, with much less spying after 9/11, of course, it became rampant and it was on steroids. But back in the 80s and the 90s, the cables and stuff were a little more focused and limited. But by and large, one of the main aims of these spy operations of our CIA and whatever and offense, is to get blackmail on leaders. So if you find out, obviously sex affairs are a wonderful form of blackmail, but it's amazing that spying is, some of it's on things like what AIPAC got, the Iran intelligence, but a lot of the spying is on personal stuff because they want to gain control of as many foreign leaders as possible. And that's one of the mechanisms that's one of the reasons for the spying. And so in any case, going back to what I was just saying, our country, the United States, certainly Israel, and any country that has the ability does this. And so to have this outrage now that even if, let's say that there was a Russian hacker, even if there was a Russian hacker, and even if that hacker was somehow connected in some ways to government entities or to military entities in the Soviet Union or in Russia, that is normal. And you know what? The officials that are out there in the public airwaves pretending to be so surprised and outraged and ginning up this, of course, World War III practically based on this, absolutely know that this is just common everyday occurrence that all countries try to. Read a John le Carré book. read a John le Carré book. This is the spy world. This is the spook world. This is what has always gone on. Probably digitized communications and the ether that all of these contacts and communications are flying have changed things just a little bit in terms of the technology. So that has changed a little bit because the spying used to be more human-based and it used to be in hard paper documents and things like that. So there's been maybe a little change that way. Otherwise, there's no change. This has been going on since time immemorial. And yet we get our newspapers and our mass media telling us that it's an act of war. We have John McCain and even our media telling us it's an act of war now for something that's been going on for decades.
It's interesting. You mentioned it, topsy-turvy. It certainly is. The first person who interviewed Julian Assange about this was not Amy Goodman on Democracy Now!, but Sean Hannity on Fox News. And Amy interviewed Assange just the other day. And then the very last part of the program, she brought in Alan Nairn, a really fine journalist, who made a fool out of himself by accusing Trump of having Julian Assange of having endorsed Trump, which he never did, and Trump corrected him and said, "What I said was it's like a vote between Clinton and Trump is like choosing cholera or gonorrhea." He didn't say which was which, but in any case, and so Nairn looked like a fool trying to talk about Russian interference in our election. And Assange mentioned we have interfered in 81 elections.
Yeah.
And really interfered to the point of people dying, assassinations and so on. And even getting Boris Yeltsin elected was a whole American team that was over there doing that. So this holier-than-thou attitude and it never goes away. It doesn't matter who's in Washington and who's writing columns in the media. It's a national disease.
Absolutely. I know we don't have a real long time to talk, and I want to kind of encourage listeners to take responsibility now. Instead of elected leaders, these politicians of both parties, it does not matter which, and there's that tendency to, of course, always a hope for this new benevolent leader. I think that was some of the Trump populism, besides the fact that he was making really promises about non-intervention and vilifying regime change. So there was some reason for the Trump populism, but there was also, as always, just the normal people who want to think that they can get behind a leader and that it really will change they will act for the public good instead of for their own narrow, corrupt selves, etc. I think right now what listeners need to know is we, the people, across the board, need to do more, take action. Our VIPS group is a really good symbol of this. We are just nobodies. There's thousands and actually millions of government retirees that are just happy to collect a pension, go traveling, play with the grandchildren. Ray McGovern, Ann Wright, Thomas Drake, Larry Wilkerson, myself, but now we have a whole little core group of people who have said, I am happy in retirement, but I don't want the world to end tomorrow. I don't want World War III. I look out there, and I can tell from what I experienced in government about how these systemic pressures come on people like Mattis and Masters, how the military-industrial complex, how the neocon think tanks have operated before. And I know that's going on. There are real significant indications of false intelligence, and we're going to do our darndest now to try to get that out. So Ray McGovern started this in 2003 when Colin Powell made his presentation to the UN, held up vials, completely false allegations, and Ray and some other retired CIA people founded VIPS and put out a memo saying this was wrong and, you know, it's going to lead to disastrous results. Then over the years, I think we're up to almost 40 memos. You know, we criticized the Obama administrations when Obama was about ready to bomb Syria based on false intelligence in 2013. We wrote two or three memos, you know, asking for the evidence. We did about the downing over Ukraine of the airliner. Again, all of these lying into war, which is in a long trajectory of from Gulf of Tonkin and the Lusitania and the Maine and the putting the babies out of the incubators. And every single war is started through these false flag isn't quite the right term, but these are propaganda, war propaganda lies that are used then to convince people that you know, as the Nazi said, that they are being attacked. And the lies about Russia and now most recently Syria are exactly in the same vein. And so our little group, again, average nobodies out there, takes it on ourselves to try to tell, you know, tell the officials. And a couple of times we know that officials have read them. Going back to the listeners, listeners need to do the same thing. If, you know, look out there, read for yourself, you know, keep your open, critical mind. Do not believe or trust just because I didn't vote for Trump, by the way, and I didn't vote for Hillary Clinton. Don't trust if you did vote for Trump, for instance, or if you did vote for Hillary Clinton. Come on, get a little skepticism. Keep your critical thinking skills. Read what's out there, and now remember what has gone on in the past. Remember how they ginned up the wars on Iraq and Libya and the other countries. Recall how these were complete and utter lies. The people in Benghazi were not going to be assassinated. Gaddafi was not giving Viagra to his army. You know, Shalabi was telling us a bunch of lies about Saddam's weapons of mass destruction. Remember the past. And then, you know, come on, now take the initiative. Like in my case, I do have social media, Facebook. Come on, put out the real. We have to counteract mainstream news. Mainstream news has just fallen hook, line, and sinker with this notion of perpetual war and what they call the liberal, the new liberal world order, quote unquote, which is actually for American empire. And you know, this our mainstream media gets paid that way, as does the weapons industry. Come on, pull back, see the conflicts of interest, think for yourself, and now share this information with more people. It's the only real hope we have. And I just want to mention one more thing about the Syria false information. I hope it will be made public, and I'm giving you a real scoop here because this is something that for right now I don't think is published. But our VIPs just came into possession of a paper, a 14-page paper by Theodore Postol, who is a professor emeritus at MIT. And if you remember who Theodore Postol is, an absolute expert on weapons and things like that, MIT, you know, complete science. And he was one of the main people who debunked the prior false line propaganda in 2013 that Assad had use sarin to gas his own people in Ghouta. It was MIT scientist Theodore Postol who said that these missiles or these bombs could not have had the range. Human Rights Watch was going out to the New York Times and publishing a map that showed that the sarin gas came from like 9 or more miles away. And Postol said, no, it can't even possibly travel that far. It can only travel 2 miles. And so that entire map had to be thrown away. New York Times was forced to retract a portion of its prior war propaganda in 2013. Well, it was Postal that did that. And now he's saying, do I have time to read just a part of this here about the casting doubt on the report that the White House is putting out about Syria attacking the people in Idlib province with sarin, killing the children, whatever. Do I have time to read just a portion of it?
Yeah.
Okay. The only undisputable facts stated in the White House report is the claim that a chemical attack using nerve agent occurred in Khan Shakun, Syria, on that morning. Although the White House statement repeats this point in many places within its report, the report contains absolutely no evidence that this attack was the result of a munition being dropped from an aircraft. In fact, the report contains absolutely no evidence who would indicate who was the perpetrator of this atrocity. The report repeats observations of physical effects suffered by victims with very little doubt indicate nerve agent poisoning. The only source the document cites as evidence that the attack was by the Syrian government is the crater it claims to have identified on the road in the north of Shakun. Postal located this crater using Google Earth, and there is absolutely no evidence that the crater was created by a munition designed to disperse sarin after it was dropped from an aircraft. Okay, it goes on from there that it looks like it's more likely it was a dispersed from the ground. Okay, by the way, this area where this agent, this toxin was dispersed is Al-Qaeda aligned controlled territory. And now, of course, we don't hear this on any of our mainstream news. But where the villagers were killed is controlled by Al-Qaeda-linked opposition forces to Syria. So there's no independent reporting. So Postal, using Google Earth, is looking at the crater that the White House is basing its information and intelligence on, and saying that couldn't have been dropped from an aircraft. It looks like it's from the ground. That's one fact in 14 pages. There's this 14 pages here. And again, our news people are not even asking the questions. They just look at it, children dying, sad as it is, you know, that children are killed for these reasons. It's the saddest thing in the world that children are dying under these bombs, by the way, including many of our bombs. And, you know, Ivanka Trump gets emotional upset. By the way, I don't know how anyone can watch those videos and not become emotional upset. Unfortunately, bombing Gaza, you know, I was out there too, because it's sad to see so many civilians and children being killed like this. But our mainstream news is glossing over all of the who, how, why, all of the hard questions of this, and just merely saying, jumping to the conclusion that the Syrian government is behind it without, in fact, going against most of the circumstantial evidence, for starters, and the what they call cui bono and motivation and all of the other things, and track record, if you know about Ghouta. So they're going against all of the prior evidence and now blaming Assad. And I think that most people even your listeners, probably a large majority, just have kind of gullible and have believed that the White House and Ivanka Trump, beautiful woman that she is, would not be lying to us. But what it is just very simplistic jumping to a conclusion without any actual evidence or intelligence. Ivanka Trump is not trained in intelligence. You know, she's maybe good at other things, but she's not trained on this. And all she was emotional when she saw the video. I think also, by the way, some of the neocon war hawks realize that by blaming Ivanka Trump, they have an out, because they can say, well, you know, she was just a dumb, beautiful woman, and certainly she didn't realize that this could have been a frame up or whatever. She just was emotional about it. So they're using her that way. And if in fact it does get debunked, but as the 2013 attack was largely debunked, now they have an out. They say, well, Ivanka was crying and that influenced her father.
My guest is Colleen Rowley, former FBI special agent. And we're talking about the alleged, whether the attack in alleged Syrian gas attack on civilians in Idlib province or Idlib in Syria, which Colleen and others have, other veterans, intelligence professionals for peace, and later Theodore Postol have debunked. Now, is that paper by Postol available online?
You know, I think we got access to it early, and I got my fingers crossed that it will be made public. I'm hoping it's sooner rather than later because this is such a serious mess we're in. There's something else, I think. This is my opinion. Vips has never really written or anything about this because it's so fast developing. The situation of the United States right now is that they've got the military on about four or five major war fronts, one of which is Syria. Another one is Yemen, where we are helping Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates and Qatar to battle the Houthis for their Saudi Arabia's purposes and whatever. So that, by the way, is a war front, too, because there's a plan to attack the port of Yemen. And the UN now predicts that this is already, by the way, already resulting in starvation, a real genocide, killing children in Yemen. And if that port is attacked, which cuts off all supplies, it'll be even far worse. So that's the second front. The third front is the North Korea front, where Trump is threatening through tweets to attack North Korea, probably a preemptive strike. My own opinion is that might even be the most likely first place we see this preemption, you know, use. We hope it's not nuclear, but because they talk about this all the time. China has sent 150,000 troops to the border with North Korea because, first of all, the North Koreans are trying to flood into China to escape. What a mess. Well, we've got Ukraine. There's at least four or five fronts, that the islands in the South China Seas, where the U.S. now has sent its carriers. They're doing little provocative war game things, playing around in these places, up on the border of the Balkans with Russia, at least four or five, maybe six fronts. Well, okay, is there an adult in the Pentagon? Is there an adult strategist in the Pentagon that says, think we got a recipe for disaster? We are spread so thin. You know, this isn't like Vietnam, where we at least could send all, you know, hundreds of thousands of people into Vietnam. Now, again, I'm just being a military mind here, which, I, to be honest, it's hard for me to put myself in their mode. But I think as an adult military strategist, you have to say, hey, we got to juggle these. So we've got to do one first. We can't be simultaneously on five war fronts. And I think for right now, this is, again, my opinion here, thinking like a military strategist, that they got to prioritize. And the most recent thing with Madison McMaster is saying that Syria will take a back seat. So it doesn't mean we're giving up on regime change, but they are trying to say, well, it's not our first priority. You know, we're our fighting against ISIS and Al Qaeda are our first priority. But which, by the way, is a bit of a cover up, because we've constantly been more or less helping ISIS and Al Qaeda in many ways through Saudi Arabia and through these surrounding countries. Even Israel is part of that whole mess. And I think that. You know, fighting Al Qaeda is really not a priority, or fighting ISIS is not a true priority, and they're down a little bit because of Syria and Russia having been more effective in that area. So my prediction is that we're saying Syria can go on a backseat for now, and I think that what the real chance is that we may see more provocation, if not outright, even preemptive attack on North Korea, is kind of where I, and that Houthi, the Yemen port, which I think could easily occur at the same time. I think those might be prioritized for the moment here. It doesn't mean anything about these other five war fronts that are all going on, but I think that maybe the military themselves, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, are a little bit nervous about operating on five different places all around the world. And these are all over, too. If you think South China Sea to Syria to Ukraine, they're, I mean, they're really spread throughout the world. So as great as our superpower military is, I think it's being effectively strained at this point to be operating all over like this.
Well, it's interesting that when Xi Jinping, the Chinese premier, was visiting Mar-a-Lago with Trump, that's when Trump decided to attack Syria as if to send a message to China. But I don't seriously think China is going to blink any more than Putin is going to blink. But one thing that I'm just wondering, if one of the reasons for Putin's attacking Syria and was to take the heat off of him from these three congressional investigations and one intelligence department investigation of his so-called ties with Russia. And he's trying to show that he's really tough on Russia. And suddenly all these liberals who are going after him for colluding with Putin and being his best friend and so on are now praising him. So all these newspapers, 18 articles and op-ed pieces in the five major newspapers praising Trump for his acting presidential, because I guess to act presidential is to bomb some country. I think the last president who didn't do that, who didn't bomb another country and is considered to have been weak, was Jimmy Carter. Interesting.
I think that's exactly right. There were many motivations that dovetailed here. And one was just the purely domestic political one that you just went through. Exactly right. I've actually, FAIR, which is a media watchdog, said that of 46 op-eds, only one was skeptical about not further bombing Syria. 45 of 46 were encouraging Trump to go farther and harder. That's how bad our mainstream media is. So, and you're absolutely right. That's kind of what I described with the sea change. I had a friend that emailed today and said, oh, finally, there's bipartisan consensus, and it's about bombing people. We finally have achieved a bipartisan consensus. And, war does that. This is why James Madison and the other founding fathers in their wisdom knew from King George and what had gone on before that all leaders, again, there's no such thing as a benevolent leader. They can be constrained through laws and through other pressures and powers to do the right thing. Sometimes they do when it's in their own interest too. But we should not be so gullible to believe that a leader, when they announce war on a foreign country, is doing that in our public interest. They're doing it for their own. That's exactly with Trump. He had political motivations for doing this bombing of Syria. And I don't think the lives of children mattered at all. And, of course, not just to Trump, it's to any of these people. They are in war. Many of them actually argue privately behind closed doors to take the gloves off, as Dick Cheney did, whatever, and to have what they call all-out, total war, where the old treaties about use of chemical, Sherman's March to the Sea, many of the military mind believes that if you're constrained in war and can't, through the laws of war that say that you're not supposed to kill so many civilians, it's supposed to be proportional, these different laws, but they chafe under those restraints, and they blame their losing a war. Vietnam, there's many, many West Point, PhD papers that claim that they were too restrained and that if they had just been less restrained. But this is kind of always the way of thinking. And so these people are not shocked about the killing of children. They're very inured to it. They've been through it. They've been involved with drone bombing, et cetera, et cetera. For people to believe, as most of our liberals do now in the country, believe that that we bombed Syria because we were outraged by the killing of children is completely ridiculous. Because, again, this is what war does, and it's the saddest thing in the world For listeners who don't understand, who think it's only on foreigners, that the most recent wars since the Civil War, we have not had war on U.S. soil. So other than having Cronkite or something show us the images from Vietnam or the picture from My Lai, most Americans don't even understand what is under the drone bombing regime. They don't understand how this is working on, you know, well over a million, maybe heading up closer to 2 million people as a result of all of these. And by the way, I never call it U.S. wars. I say U.S., NATO, Israel. If you've seen my Facebook, I usually say yes. All three of them, because this is an unholy alliance where we've been able to get these other countries into this perpetual war. And because Americans don't seem to be affected.
And there's no draft.
Yeah,
that's
and there's
critical.
No draft, and there's no taxes, because one of Madison's points about making war limited was he said once you raise taxes, then people will, you know, not be so anxious and eager, and you'll get the what we call Vietnam syndrome. And so there's no taxes. We're at $20 trillion and it's just skyrocketing up with Trump's call for 54 more billion. There's no austerity. That's gone. That's over. So the national debt looks to even skyrocket above 20 trillion. We're totally bankrupt, by the way. That's what that means. We can't possibly pay off 20 trillion national debt. And then, but the people don't know it because it's out of sight, out of mind. It's like spending
Colleen,
a credit card.
Colleen, we've come to the end of the hour syndrome. That's one that doesn't matter who's in office. This has been very enlightening and very interesting. I know my listeners have gotten a lot out of it. I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World, Colleen Rowley. We have to do it again, and not after 3 years.
Thank you so much,
yes.
And thanks for continuing the struggle against this silly nonsense insanity.
And look for Jeff Blank. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Pfeffer of the Institute for Policy Studies, who assesses rising tensions between the Trump administration and North Korea that risks triggering a deadly regional conflict. Sarah Shore of the climate group 350.org, who talks about the campaign to stop the Keystone XL pipeline, after President Trump reversed the Obama administration's denial of a federal construction permit. And Walt McCree, Executive Director and Chair of the Public Banking Institute, who discusses a proposal for the establishment of a public bank in New Jersey made by a leading Democratic Party candidate for governor. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
French leftist Jean-Luc Mélenchon is surging in the final days prior to the first round of the French presidential election on April 23rd. The veteran left-winger has caught up with the front-runners, independent centrist Emmanuel Macron, and the far-right nationalist anti-immigrant candidate Marine Le Pen. The top two candidates in the opening round will compete in a runoff on May 7th. Early polls show Macron, the former socialist economy minister, easily beating Le Pen in the final round. Mélenchon, who quit the Socialist Party in 2008, calls for reducing the French work week from 35 to 32 hours, lowering the retirement age to 60, and taxing earnings of more than $35,000 a month at 100%. His campaign also advocates the phasing out of nuclear power, which currently supplies 75% of French electricity needs. On foreign policy, the leftist calls for a new role for France in the EU, withdrawal from NATO, and warmer ties with Russia. The outcome of France's presidential campaign remains unpredictable, with many voters repudiating the established political parties on the left and right. Turnout for the April 23rd election is expected to be critical in determining the winners. During a tour of a military camp, Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte raised eyebrows when he promised to occupy uninhabited islands and reefs in the disputed South China Sea, in a move seen as countering China's increased military presence in the region. China immediately objected to what it perceived as a provocation in the tense Spratly Archipelago, a critical shipping lane in the Asia-Pacific. Quickly, the Philippines Defense Minister, Delfin Lorenzana, clarified that the islands in question had been controlled by the Philippines since the 1980s. The Manila government said it would be building new water and sewer systems on the islands, but would not be deploying any offensive weapons. The flip-flopping on the South China Sea, coupled with Duterte's dismissal of calls from the international community to end his brutal crackdown on illegal drugs, could further isolate the Philippines from its traditional allies, like the United States and Europe. Duterte plans to visit China in May. America's urban heroin crisis has disappeared from public view as addiction in white America has surged, receiving newfound compassionate attention from many conservative politicians. Yet African Americans and Latinos quietly suffer, largely out of the public spotlight, from a heroin epidemic driven by poverty, lack of substance abuse treatment, and AIDS. The number of heroin addicts is growing and can now easily be found in both middle-class enclaves and in poor rural communities alike. Since 2000, the number of heroin overdoses by white addicts has spiked by over 500%. According to the news magazine In These Times, the frequency of drug deaths among African Americans has doubled over the last decade. On the poor west side of Chicago, it is commonplace for suburban whites to search for a heroin fix. Yet in Illinois, African Americans die from drug overdoses more frequently than whites. Advocates such as Katie Kane Willis of the Illinois Consortium on Drug Policy say a leading culprit in the racial disparity of drug overdoses are budget cuts targeting substance abuse treatment programs and the high number of blacks and Latinos who lack basic health insurance. But unlike the 1980s and 1990s, where arrest and incarceration were the public policy of choice for those who used crack and other illegal drugs, the policy advocated by right-wing politicians today for opioid users is treatment. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
As North Korea celebrated the 105th birthday of its founder, Kim Il-sung, on April 15th, tensions rose to a dangerous level on the Korean peninsula. In response to a failed missile test and concern about a possible sixth nuclear weapons test, President Trump deployed a U.S. aircraft carrier task force to the waters off Korea and issued several threats against the regime of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Mr. Trump accused the North of looking for trouble and ominously warned that if China did not assist in reducing the threat posed by Pyongyang's nuclear program, then the U.S., he said, will solve the problem without them. News reports, later denied by the White House, stated that the Trump administration was, for the first time, considering using conventional weapons to launch a preemptive strike against North Korea if the country was about to conduct another nuclear weapons test. In response, North Korea promised to retaliate against the U.S. with a nuclear weapon if Washington launched a preemptive strike. Later, Vice President Mike Pence, visiting Seoul, South Korea's capital, warned that North Korea should not test the strength of the armed forces of the United States in this region, while also leaving open the possibility of negotiations. Your reporter spoke with John Pfeffer, Director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, who discusses rising tensions between the Trump administration and North Korea that risks triggering a deadly conflict on the Korean Peninsula and across the region.
You know, wars often break out not because of rational calculations, but because of irrational desires or ambitions, emotional responses, revenge. So, everybody who on this side of the Pacific, who is thinking about the Korean Peninsula, recognizes that a war would be devastating, devastating not only for North Korea, but devastating to U.S. allies, South Korea and Japan, would be a self-inflicted wound if the United States were to start such a war. And I think that everybody in North Korea realizes that the same holds true there, that an attack by North Korea against the United States, managed to somehow do that, or against South Korea or Japan, would also be a self-inflicted wound. And yet, despite that understanding, it's still very possible for a chain of events to escalate and produce an effect that no one wants, which everybody blunders into, much like, say, World War I.
John Pfeffer, how would you assess the threat posed to the United States and U.S. allies in Asia by North Korea at this point?
Well, I don't think North Korea poses any threat to the United States, honestly, because its missiles can't reach the United States. It can challenge, for instance, the 28,000 to 30,000 U.S. troops in South Korea. It can challenge U.S. allies in South Korea, Japan, but a direct threat to the U.S. homeland, no, not at this point. North Korea can be devastating in its attack on South Korea. It has a huge amount of artillery positions stationed just over the border, within firing distance of Seoul, and that would be terrifying. I mean, there's approximately 20 million people who live in the greater Seoul area. So any kind of attack that would involve Seoul would be just catastrophic. So I think that's one of the reasons why the United States has effectively avoided any kind of thinking about preemptive strikes against North Korea, because it knows that any retaliation against South Korea would be, even if it didn't precipitate further war, it would still lead to enormous civilian casualties.
In a recent article, you talked about some of the ways that a negotiated solution to the tensions in the Korean Peninsula might be able to move forward. And I'm wondering if you'd summarize a bit of what North Korea is looking for and where some kind of deal might be able to be struck in the future.
Sure. Well, basically North Korea wants to end its isolation. It doesn't want to be isolated militarily. It doesn't want to be surrounded militarily. It doesn't want to be isolated diplomatically. It wants, to achieve international recognition as a legitimate state. And it doesn't want to be isolated economically. The regime of sanctions has prevented international capital from entering the country and helping rebuild the infrastructure, and the industry, the agriculture. So it sees the United States largely as the kind of key player in reducing its isolation. The United States is the most powerful country in the world. It holds the keys to the international economy. If the United States were to recognize North Korea diplomatically, its allies would follow suit. So that's what North Korea wants. It wants a deal with the United States that could end its isolation. In order to to secure that with North Korea, however, the United States is going to have to step back from the precondition that the Obama administration placed on North Korea, and that was for North Korea to get rid of its nukes before it can even get to the negotiating table. That's a non-starter. The other thing is that there has to be a gradual process of denuclearization at this point, because North Korea is not going to give up its single bargaining chip, its single most important deterrent, just on the promise that the United States will treat it fairly. So I think those are the key elements for any negotiation going forward.
South Korea has gone through a lot of political turmoil in recent months, and their leader, their conservative party leader, has stepped down. There's a new election coming up, and it's possible that a newly elected South Korean president could be an advocate of the old sunshine policy, which favored rapprochement with North Korea. How could the coming election in South Korea change or reduce the tensions on the peninsula there?
Yeah, it's an important question. I mean, basically, South Korea had 10 years of conservative rule that ended with Park Geun-hye being impeached and thrown into jail on corruption charges. And those 10 years were effectively a step away from the Sunshine Policy, a step away from engagement with North Korea diplomatically and economically. We're going to see a new president, probably someone of the center left, like Han Chol-soo, or even more progressive, like Moon Jae-in, both of whom I think support a much more engagement-friendly approach to North Korea. I think there's also a kind of a wellspring of public sentiment at this point to try something new. The last 10 years were not successful, really, in changing North Korean behavior or in advancing reunification in any meaningful way. We saw the closure of some important projects like the Kaesong Industrial Complex, an economic cooperation program between North and South Korea. So I think people are saying, hey, you know, the hardline policies, it didn't really work. I think it's time for something new.
That was John Pfeffer, Director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of The Future of U.S.-Korean Relations. Find more perspectives on North Korea's nuclear weapons program and the future of a negotiated solution by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In November 2015, President Obama announced his decision to deny a permit to the TransCanada Company, which needed it to build the Keystone XL pipeline across the Canadian border from the Alberta tar sands mining operations to where it would connect to an already existing pipeline in Nebraska that had been earlier approved and built under Obama. The permit denial was considered a great people-powered victory for the climate movement, as it brought together environmentalists, property owners along the route of the pipeline, ranchers, farmers, and indigenous communities in the upper Midwest. Then, as one of his first acts as president, Donald Trump resurrected the Keystone XL, promising thousands of jobs, partly through using pipes made of U.S. steel, despite the fact that the company had already purchased pipes mostly manufactured abroad. The environmental group 350.org was a leader in the fight to kill the KXL pipeline the first time around, and is now gearing up to do so again. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Sarah Shore, lead organizer with 350.org's Keystone XL pipeline campaign. Here she talks about the focus of the campaign this time, that revolves around a federal lawsuit, the pipeline permitting process in Nebraska, and the decreasing price of oil.
The strategy last time around was really to influence Obama. That was the 350 strategy, was to influence Obama. There were also lots of other groups working on other angles of the fight. This time, we know we're not going to be able to influence Trump. So we are organizing around other angles of this fight. The main ones that you'll see a bunch of pushback on are the federal lawsuit. Obama went through a multi-year process to determine whether the Keystone XL pipeline was in the public interest of Americans, and ultimately decided that it was not because it significantly contributed to climate change. And on that basis, rejected the permit after years of study. Trump spent 3 months reversing that decision. And so he actually didn't go through the proper processes, and Sierra Club and NRDC will be suing the federal government to basically make the argument that this was an illegal decision by the Trump administration that didn't actually take public comment or a real study into consideration, and that's illegal. So that'll be one leg that we'll be fighting on. Another one is Nebraska. The Keystone XL pipeline does not have a legal route through Nebraska. It has not been permitted through the state of Nebraska, and the Public Service Commission has to actually determine that Keystone XL is in the public interest of Nebraskans, and that is a process that's happening now in the state. We, as 350.org, are interveners in that process. There are also dozens of landowners and several organizations that have been approved as interveners in that process, and we will be generating public comments and putting a ton of pressure on the Public Service Commission in Nebraska to stop this pipeline. If they do approve it, there are about 85 landowners in Nebraska who have not given up their land to easements to TransCanada, who the state will be using eminent domain to take their land to build this pipeline, and they will be suing the state of Nebraska to say this is not in our public interest. So that's another leg. And then I would say the third leg, which is maybe the most important one, is Keystone XL has mobilized millions of people over the last several years to take action on climate and on fossil fuel issues. And it helped spur dozens of other fights against other fossil fuel pipelines across the U.S., across Canada, across the world. And revitalizing this fight on Keystone will only help us build the movement across the board. Just like what happened in the past when fighting Keystone helped us build the movement to fight several other pipelines at once, that's going to happen again, and we're only going to see more and more fights against the fossil fuel industry being taken on because Trump has now brought this fight back to center stage.
Sarah Shore, the economics from TransCanada's point of view seem to be worse than they were when the company started this process more than 10 years ago. For one thing, the price of oil has dropped significantly.
Absolutely. This pipeline isn't needed. The economics behind it are incredibly poor. That could absolutely play a role in whether this pipeline gets built or not. Also, you know, the price of extraction of tar sands, which is one of the dirtiest fossil fuels in the world, is really expensive. It's really costly to extract. It's really costly to transport. It's really costly to refine. And this pipeline just isn't needed. The economics behind it are not there, and it doesn't make sense to build this pipeline.
How big a role do you think the fight against the Keystone XL pipeline will play in the People's Climate March in Washington, D.C. on April 29th? I know 350 has been heavily involved in organizing it.
I mean, I think that a lot of people came into this movement because of the Keystone XL pipeline, and they will be there at the People's Climate March marching. There will be a big fossil fuel resistance block within the march that will probably be much themed around Keystone XL and other infrastructure projects. And ultimately, this fight is bigger than one pipeline. New fossil fuel infrastructure projects are facing resistance everywhere, and Keystone will once again stoke the flames of all of those other fights.
That was Sarah Shore, U.S. Keep It in the Ground campaign manager with the climate group 350.org. Learn more about continuing opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline project by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After the meltdown of the U.S. and much of the world economy in 2008 and 2009, movements including Occupy Wall Street emerged that condemned Wall Street for its role in exacerbating growing income inequality in America and abroad. Beyond simply slamming the system, some progressive economists and activists put forward a number of ideas for restructuring the U.S. financial and banking system that offered alternatives for a more equitable model to better serve the interests of consumers, small business, and the nation as a whole. Among those ideas was support for a government bank that would offer competition to the nation's largest privately held banks that recklessly engaged in casino-like gambling and lost billions of dollars of their customers' investments during the Great Recession. The public banking option comes from the successful example of the 98-year-old Bank of North Dakota, the nation's only statewide publicly owned bank. Some observers credit North Dakota's public banking system for the state's large budget surpluses during the economic collapse. Your reporter spoke with Walt McCree, executive director and chair of the Public Banking Institute, who discusses the recent proposal for the establishment of a public bank in New Jersey made by Phil Murphy, a former Wall Street executive who's now a leading Democratic Party candidate running for New Jersey governor.
A public bank is a bank that's owned by the people, owned by the public.
And typically, in the instances that we refer to it, it's owned by the cities or the counties or the states that own the bank. So that instead of shareholders and stakeholders, you have the citizens who are the ones who use the bank and benefit from the bank just as if they had a private bank. And the, you know, the power of that is that the franchise of banking is basically a license to create money. You know, it's a proven franchise that works brilliantly, and of course it can be misused. But the public's potential here is to be able to keep the money that is collected as taxes and fees and licenses, all the money that comes over the transom of the body politic, is kept at home in our own bank instead of sent off to Wall Street. And of course, when Wall Street gets the money, they go off and they use it to leverage and make profits and play the global casino of speculation. And, you know, they do very well. And they do that with our money. What the public bank does is basically gives it a new place to go so that the city and the county, the state can design, create, and fund the finance itself for things like infrastructure or student lending or perhaps affordable housing, a host of things that all of us know that we'd like to have our communities be able to do but haven't had the money to do that. So it's quite a new day. There's only one public bank in the United States at the moment. That's the Bank of North Dakota, which has been called the most profitable bank in America. It outproduces by 70% to 100% the return on equity of the Wall Street banks, J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs. It's a highly productive bank that has been financing North Dakota and stabilizing that economy for 98 years.
Since its founding in 2010, yourself and Ellen Brown, the founder of the Public Banking Institute, have been proselytizing across the country, advocating for public banks to be established elsewhere, apart from North Dakota. Now we have a Democratic candidate for governor in New Jersey, Phil Murphy, who's really made establishing a public bank in New Jersey one of the centerpieces of his campaign to win the governorship there. Maybe you could tell us about what's going on in New Jersey and if you're optimistic that we can finally have a second public bank established in another state after all these years.
Yeah, we get a new one every 100 years. You know, it's a trend.
Yeah.
Actually, Phil Murphy's candidacy in New Jersey is big in many ways because it has mainstreamed the awareness of what a public bank is, as well as brought it into even a mainstream political environment. Phil Murphy has a Goldman Sachs background. He's a banker. And as Ellen Brown says, you know, the reason he gets it is that he's a banker. He knows how banks work and how it can be used. His candidacy is doing very well. You know, he seems to be the odds-on favorite to win. He's very serious about it. New Jersey is a rich state, but it's in a basket. You know, it's in a basket case. It has huge debt. Murphy feels that by having a public bank, they'll do exactly what I said earlier. We'll keep our money in the state, invest in ourselves, finance ourselves. So we're really very hopeful. And the people and the vibe in New Jersey is very strong, strongly in favor of it. Certainly there are people pushing back, but those are often people from the Wall Street and the big banks and the other side of approach here. Around the country, there are over 50 initiatives underway now. It's really a growing movement, and it is indeed a movement. I mean, we have the city of Santa Fe is getting very close to the point where they're going to be assigning a task force to be able to move forward with a charter, to get a bank chartered there. In Philadelphia, that is also right in the middle of the city council at the moment. Oakland, Portland, Seattle, about 9 cities in California, including the state, Arizona, New Mexico, Albuquerque, and Santa Fe, I mentioned. Minneapolis is taking a look at it. There's Massachusetts, also Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, Maryland, and the state of Pennsylvania are the ones that come to mind. I've left out Michigan and Illinois, but you get the picture. It's a pretty exciting prospect, not happening too soon.
That was Walt McCree, executive director and chair of the Public Banking Institute. For more information on the public banking option, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
What is the history behind the China-Philippines standoff in the South China Sea, and how is the United States involved? What could be the consequences for the West, and particularly the United States, if China maintains its control over vital naval and land routes, like the planned One Belt, One Road project? Is a convergence between China, Russia, and Iran hurting the U.S.? How critical is the overthrow of the Houthis in Yemen to U.S. hegemony in the region? What should one read into the popularity of Marie Le Pen's hard right positions on the EU and migrant policy during the French elections? On this week's Global Research News Hour, our focus is on some of the forces surrounding the major hotspots around the globe. Our guests include political studies professor Radhika Desai and author and geopolitical analyst Mahdi Nazemroya. On this week's program, Flashpoints 2017, South China Sea, Yemen, and beyond. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 21st, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, unoccupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. During this period of quote-unquote peace, the United States has played the role of major hegemonic world power. During this period of quote-unquote peace, the United States has been engaged in vicious conflict in North Korea and Vietnam, has decimated Iraq, Libya, and Afghanistan, and is in the process of trying to complete its work in Syria. It has 700 military bases, replete with 170 golf courses, in 170 countries. And its nuclear warheads on the borders of Russia are targeting key Russian cities. However, quote-unquote peace advocates might argue there was no war between the major powers. That comes from the article Endgame, The War Machine Goes On, part 4 of a 6-part essay by Arthur D. Robbins, posted April 20th. The government should make radical decisions and seek ways to deal with this new reality of Erdogan's theocratic ambitions for the Islamization of Hellenic Cyprus. Only the Archbishop of Cyprus dared to speak openly about those fears, but nobody takes him seriously. As for most of the inglorious Cypriot politicians, well, that's another story. While other superpowers offer lip service and fail to support Cyprus, Russia offers the only hope on the table for protecting the island against such dictators. Certainly not the EU or the UN, not while most member states support Turkey. That comes from the article Cyprus and the Death of Democracy in Turkey by Andreas C. Chrysaphis, posted April 20th. Today, April 19th, 2017, is the 22nd anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. The bombing of the Federal Murrah office building was blamed by federal authorities on a bomb made from fertilizer inside a truck parked in front of the building by Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols. There are many anomalies associated with the official explanation, including mysterious deaths of some, including a police officer who understood that the actual facts did not accord with the explanation. Investigators who report the actual facts are branded conspiracy theorists and dismissed. This has been the deep state's way of controlling explanations since the 1940s. That comes from the article, The Oklahoma City Bombing After 22 Years, by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted April 20th. The suggestion from the late Emma Morano, who recently passed at a venerable 117 years, being supposedly the only confirmed and recorded centurion remaining from 1899, was one of humble egg consumption. The diet was simple, though eventually losing one's teeth helped to move one away from more complex solids. Morano's death caused the usual springs to come into play. Diet was discussed, forms of lifestyle were considered, anti-aging mechanisms were pored over and devoured. The modern class of wizardry, nutritionists, were eager to make their views felt. The lifestyle blogosphere lit up with starry-eyed wonder. That comes from the article, The Secrets of Long Life and Anti-Aging, The Passing of Emma Morano at 117 Years Old, How Did She Do It? By Dr. Binoy Kampmark, posted April 19th. The evidence surprisingly does point to a consistent pattern of Israeli state policy aims that has involved facilitating the emergence and the sustenance of militant Islamic organizations. In order to understand this phenomenon, it is important to be aware of the historical policies pursued by the state of Israel, which have been predicated on the idea of weakening its opponents in order to reduce external threats to its security. This feeds into an overarching goal of balkanizing Muslim Arab nations and the manipulation of tribal and sectarian rivalries within such polities as a means of achieving this end. It is while bearing this in mind that evidence of Israel's support of an Islamist militia during the Soviet-Afghan War, terror groups in Iran, a group of insurrectionists in Yemen and jihadist militias in the ongoing Syrian civil war becomes a phenomenon that is more readily comprehended. It also explains why Israel supplied weapons to Iran during its war with Iraq and why Israel effectively aided the creation of the Palestinian Islamist organization Hamas. That comes from the article, Israel and Islamist Militias, A Strange and Recurring Alliance, by Adiyinka Makinde, posted April 20th, originally appearing at adiyinkamakinde.blogspot.ca. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. I'm joined here by two friends and geopolitical and economic analysts who are going to help me parse through some of the major flashpoints around the globe at the moment and try to contextualize them in terms of some of the main forces driving the current set of state of affairs. So to my right, I'm joined by Radhika Desai. She is professor at the Department of Political Studies and director of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group, both based at the University of Manitoba. She's the author of a number of books, including Geopolitical Economy After U.S. Hegemony, Globalization and Empire from 2013. She's also the author of numerous articles in Economic and Political Weekly, New Left Review, Third World Quarterly and other journals, and in edited collections on parties, political economy, culture, and nationalism. She also co-edits with Alan Freeman the Geopolitical Economy book series with Manchester University Press and the Future of Capitalism book series with Pluto Press. And on my left, we are joined by Mahdi Darius Nazimroya. He's a sociologist, award-winning author, and geopolitical analyst who currently teaches at the University of the Philippines. He's the author of The Globalization of NATO.
He's a research associate at the Center for Research on Globalization and a member of the Scientific Committee of Geopolitica, a peer-reviewed journal of geopolitical science in Italy. So thank you both of you for joining us. I thought maybe we'd start our conversation with an examination of some of the tensions that are growing between the United States and China. There's been a lot of concern over the last month with regard to the South China Sea, where there's the Scarborough Shoal, which is basically being contested by the Philippines and China. And so we've been seeing some interesting developments there. There's been, over the past year, U.S. maneuvers in that area. And so it looks as if there's some tensions growing there, although I understand that the President Duterte seems to be trying to diminish that rhetoric as they're trying to rebalance their economic and diplomatic imperatives. Although I understand, I think it was in March 20th, it was the Philippine Supreme Court Justice Antonio Carpio intervened and proposed sending the Philippine Navy to patrol that area. And in the event of a Chinese attack, they could invoke the Philippine-U.S. Mutual Defense Treaty. So it looks like there's something growing there, and I wonder if you might be able to contextualize that for us. Mari, I know you've done a lot of research in that area. What are your thoughts as you look at that those developments in the South China Sea?
Well, I'd like to start off by saying that the situation is not black and white. Maybe that's a very simplistic way to start off, because the Chinese are being demonized. They're not at fault with many of the allegations being brought about against them. They're not guilty of those allegations. They're not totally clear either. There are nuances, I'd have to say. I want to start off by saying that, first of all, the issue of the South China Sea is politicized. If you look at the ownership, the legal issues, the geographic definitions. There's legal definitions involved here. It's much more complicated. First of all, we have to look back to at the Philippines as an American territory. The Spanish-American War, the Philippines was surrendered through the Treaty of Paris to the United States of America, as well as Puerto Rico, Cuba. The Spanish lost these possessions. So the Philippines turned from a Spanish colony to an American colony. This is very important because within the treaty, within the conditions of surrender of the transfer of the Philippines, there was geographic boundaries. The South China Sea, the islands there are not within those geographic boundaries. That's the first thing you have to take note of. The second thing you have to take note of is that when the Japanese annexed Taiwan, when the Japanese Empire annexed Taiwan, they took certain islands in the South China Sea. When they took these islands from the Chinese, they said this is part of the province of Taiwan, more or less. Japanese who took these islands recognized the islands as Chinese territory in the South China Sea. The only countries that protested, aside from China, was France. And the reason was France said these were part of Vietnam. So the Vietnamese legal claim is based on the claim that this was part of Vietnamese territory. And the Chinese had their claim. There was the United States, the State Department, did not say anything about the issue. And in fact, when the Japanese surrendered, and there's a treaty that the United States helped broker between the Philippines and the Republic of China, which is now Taiwan. The Republic of China, which is Taiwan and Japan, when that treaty was negotiated, those islands are several, not all of them, are mentioned as being returned to China. And at the time, this was the nationalists. So there's this legal background. Where the Chinese are playing around is, or you might we might critique the Chinese on is on the issue of the definitions of these land formations, rocks. The Chinese claim that there some of them are different legal definitions. Basically, it's not a low altitude, it's not a low elevation, it's not a rock. The reason for that is because of the issue of adjacent waters and exclusive economic zone. So the Chinese want to claim as much as they can. And this is where the Philippines took them to court. That's what the court case was about. It wasn't about ownership. It was on the definitions, the geo-legal definitions of what those islands are. But to understand the Chinese position of why the Chinese are pushing for their interpretation of the geo-legal definitions of these islands is because the Chinese have security interests. First of all, this is the South China Sea is very important lifeline for Chinese trade and energy supplies. It always has been. The American, the Pentagon actually is the one that coins the term string of pearls. It means Chinese bases in the Indian Ocean and West Pacific. The Chinese are setting up these string of pearls to protect their routes, the trade routes, like the Maritime Silk Road, which is coming into fruition, and to the energy corridors, aside from the land ones they're building now with Russia, Kazakhstan, and Central Asia. But so their interest is to say and claim as much of adjacent waters and exclusive economic zones as possible. And the United States is now, which doesn't even, United States hasn't even signed the UN convention, the law of the seas. You know, it's accusing the Chinese of breaking it. And increasingly you have Japan, all these NATO members like France doing military exercises in the South China Sea. Or several thousand ships go through there, and there hasn't been any real problem. Statistically, it's like 0.001, something like that, if you do the figures. Empirically, if you want to do the figures on how many problems there's been with China. In fact, one other thing I want to bring into account is that the Philippines once had a military conflict, small skirmish with somebody over these islands, but it was Vietnam, and actually it was South Vietnam, which was the ally of the Philippines and the United States over one of the islands. That's the only time there's been a really violent clash was between an ally of the Philippines, South Vietnam. And in fact, the most militarily aggressive country in the South China Sea is actually Vietnam, because it declares those area islands that it has under military administration. But we hear all about China. We don't hear about the Philippines' claim against Vietnam or Malaysia. The issue of the Taiwan and China is a little different. But
it's like you say, it's being politicized.
It's been politicized because the United States, first of all, wants to use that as an excuse to create a military cordon there.
That's that they have the Asia pivot.
This is just used to justify the Asia pivot, the militarization of that. The Americans are building bases in the Philippines right now as we speak, secretly in the South, Mindanao. The issue of terrorism in South Philippines has also helped with building these bases, which are against the Constitution of the Philippines. They're against the Constitution of the Philippines. And in fact, the group Abu Sayyaf, which is active in the Southern Philippines, was established when the Filipino Congress was against U.S. bases. You know, so there's a lot of other backstories to what's happening there.
Yeah, I mean, just to maybe get back to that in a second. I wanted to get Radhika's perspective on this because, I mean, Madi just referenced the One Belt, One Road project and the naval aspect of it. And we've seen that China being a growing power, and there's, you know, these new routes that will enhance that regional trade. And that's going up very much against U.S. Imperial or hegemonic interests. So I'm wondering if you could maybe address that discussion a little bit and how you see these developments in the South China Sea in an economic context.
Sure. Let me just begin by mentioning that the rising tensions in the South China Sea is part of a larger pattern, a pattern that you may say is kind of post-Cold War, or it's like a new Cold War pattern. Although I would also like to suggest that this has a much older provenance, in the sense that there is a certain dynamic of American actions over the last century or more, which explains all of this. Essentially, I would say that historically the United States has always tried to create a world in which its own corporations would have full freedom of movement, investment, trade, etc. And this requires, if this sort of world is to be realized, it requires the suppression of two different but related things. One is the assertion of the sovereignty of other countries, and the other is the ability of other countries to pursue forms of economic development which would go athwart the rights that the U.S. would like its own corporations to have. Now, I have to also say one other thing before we proceed further. The idea that the United States is hegemonic or imperial is certainly, it's been very prevalent and all that, but one has to remember that while this has been the project of the United States has not really succeeded in this. And in fact, that in the times in which we live now, it is definitely, its power is slipping away even faster than it was doing before. So this is the broader context. Now, this, if you see it in this context, and what you realize is that the pattern of demonization, whether it is of China or Russia or Venezuela, the leaders of these countries, or in China's case, the country as a whole, this is a pattern of demonization which is precisely directed against leaders of countries that have tried to strike out on their own, trying to pursue a different form of economic development, and which could also pose a challenge in China's case, and in the case partially of Russia, they also pose a challenge to the United States internationally. So this kind of demonization is routine, and it's very sad that the Western press largely follows the dictates. You know, we are often told that the press in China is not independent, it follows the government line. Well, look at our press. How free does it look to you? How independent does it look to you? So that's one thing. Now, the other thing I'd like to stress is to take off from something that that Mahdi was saying. What's happening in the South China Sea should be understood in a larger context, where what China is trying to do is defend certain arrangements that are critical for it. Such a huge part of China's trade and energy supplies flow through those narrow straits that come off the South China Sea, that for China not to have some kind of control over what happens there is to actually subject itself to a wider world environment in which it has no control over what it most essentially needs to control. By contrast, the United States has a perception of its security interests, what you may call the forward security interests, where it needs to fight wars and raise tensions thousands of miles away from its own border. So the United States thinks it's perfectly legitimate for it to say its interests are being violated in the Middle East or in China or in Ukraine, which are thousands of miles away from where the U.S. is, whereas Russia or China are defending their own interests within their own neighborhoods. This is what's happening. I'd also like to say a few other things that also put it in the context. We talked about the pivot to Asia. This was certainly part of Obama's policy. It was part of a policy in which it was the Obama administration's response to the realization that China's economic strength and therefore naturally its geopolitical and other strengths were rising, that the Chinese government was never going to be simply kowtow to American interests and the American line. So this was an independent power which they could not really allow in a sense. And so the pivot to Asia was part of a military as well as commercial strategy to try to project American interest in that area. Now, the economic part of the strategy lies in tatters. The TPP is dead. In fact, even before the Trump administration finally said, we are closing this whole initiative. In fact, it was not really, the TPP was not really such a powerful force against China. And there's one very, very simple reason. There's a new book that's coming out, the first one in our geopolitical economy book series, which is about China and its neighborhood and the new Cold War between the U.S. and China. And what it shows very definitively, it's by Jude Woodward, who is a British scholar. What Jude shows in this book is that what you see when you examine China's neighborhood is that even countries that can occasionally be provoked by Western interests, particularly the United States, into taking some stances in opposition to China, actually are becoming so deeply integrated into the regional political economy, which is dominated by China, that they cannot in any systematic and sustained fashion and should not go against. And China is not an imperial power. China is simply creating a largely benign economic environment of dynamic economic growth in which these countries would be foolish not to participate. So that's the larger context. The economic strategy lies in tatters. So now what the U.S. has remaining as the only option is to try and increase tensions between some of its traditional allies, such as the United States, or the Philippines is now teetering, tottering. Perhaps Mahdi will say a little bit more about how he sees Duterte's what exactly is the underlying pattern of Duterte's policies. But there's always Vietnam and so on. But in general, I would say that this ability to provoke tensions is not going to be very successful. I mean, take the example of Taiwan.
Well, I think if you look at right now, I mean, even just it seems as if the way the response, the players like Russia and China, as the United States moves forward, it seems to be the reaction seems to be growing cohesion between Russia and China.
Exactly.
And Iran.
Exactly. And in fact, in many ways, the Americans are driving these countries together. The most recent country that it has driven in that direction is Turkey, which has, historically been an American ally. But given the manner in which the Americans have essentially reacted to certain key initiatives by the Erdogan regime, and it would seem also participated in an attempt to destabilize that government, it would seem that Turkey is going to go in that direction as well. So what the United States would love to do is to divorce China from the ever closer embrace in which it is coming with its own neighbors, but this is not going to be particularly successful. And one final point I'd like to make is that in this context, especially with the Trump administration going out of its way to alienate its European allies, it would seem that Europe is also standing at a kind of crossroads where Europe's own reaction to the Ukraine crisis and other flashpoints has been relatively independent, and every so often the United States tries to cow Europe into agreeing to it. But remember, if there were to be a war in these theaters, Europe would be very directly affected. The European economy is also reliant on Russian energy supplies and so on. So they have a direct interest in not antagonizing the Russians to such an extent, even though they are capitalist countries and they may not, they may have differences with Russia. They would rather manage these differences in a different way than the Americans. Oh, and one final point, sorry. I think that in this context, the United States policies cannot be fully understood, what it's trying to do and so on, unless you realize one other thing about the United States, and that is that in the context of malingering economy, the American military-industrial complex is a very powerful entity, both in terms of its importance in economic importance, as a share of the product of U.S. GDP and U.S. exports in particular, but then another sense in the extent of its political influence. I think that in many ways, the belligerence that you have seen in the United States, much of which has not resulted in any net gains for U.S. or its corporations, except in the sense that they create a lot of money for American defense corporations.
Yeah, the military-industrial media complex.
Yes. And so you have to also understand that a good part of what's happening in the United States and a good part of American policymaking cannot be understood unless you understand that there is a kind of military-industrial complex tail wagging the American policy and economic dog.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Madi, I wanted to. We were, hearing what Radical was saying about these vital routes that were critical for China. I was also reminded of another very critical route, and that was the one that's that brings us to another flashpoint of Yemen. There's that Strait of Bab al-Mandab, which is so strategic. That's through which 40% of oil is shipped. And this is, I think, part, as I see it, it's part of a major route, a trade route. In addition to the whole, New Silk Road, One Belt, One Road, there's this, that too is a very critical route, in terms of, and that very much binds Europe, close to Asia. And so what we're seeing right now in Yemen, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's largely about maintaining that, Western U.S. control of that critical area. And so we see the Gulf states, Qatar and Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, all those real, democracy-minded countries intervening to protect the to restore the former president to his against these Iranian-backed Houthi rebels. So anyway, that's how do you look when you look at that particular region? When you look at Yemen, what stands out for you?
Okay. Well, first we should clear some issues about the Gate of Tears, as it's called in English. That's the English name for it. The first thing we should talk about in Yemen is that the president that was supposedly removed, al-Hadi, had passed his term. There was nothing unconstitutional. They were trying to keep him in place, and they were trying to force something unconstitutional on various groups, so-called Iranian-backed groups. They're not all Iranian-backed, actually. And second thing is, what's happening in Yemen is not an issue of Shiite Muslims versus Sunni Muslims, because they're both sides are mixed. And in fact, the so-called Houthi were actually supported by Saudi Arabia. During the civil war against the predecessors to the Houthis, which wanted an imamate in Yemen who fought the Marxists and the nationalists, were supported by Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Britain during the civil war in Yemen. There was two Yemens at the time. So we'll make that clear. The Houthi worked with the Saudis. It's only later on that there was differences, and the problems that emerged in Yemen, there's the Arabian dimension to it, which has to do with some of Saudi Arabia's interests, but there are also the broader interests which you touched upon. It's the Gate of Tears, shipping that goes through there. I would say it connects Asia to Europe, Europe to Asia. It's not one way. It's both ways. The Suez Canal is useless without that strait. The Suez Canal is at the northern side of the Red Sea, connects the Mediterranean to the Red Sea, and that strait connects the Red Sea to the Indian Ocean, the Arabian Sea and the broader Indian Ocean. So one thing that both the Russians, the Iranians, actually all three of them, not two, the Russians, the Iranians, and the Chinese are aware of is that in American policy, controlling that strait, the U.S. has two initiatives. We control Syria and we control Yemen, then we can attack Iran. That's an American objective. I'm not saying they're going to attack Iran, but for the United States, prerequisites to a war with Iran include controlling that strait and
removing Syria from its alliance with Iran or neutralizing Syria. So the Russians and the Iranians and their strategists are very aware of this. The other factor is also the United States wants to control choke points around the world. Choke points are like the Bosphorus, you know, where Istanbul is between Europe and Asia, the Red Sea, the Straits of Hormuz, the Straits of Malacca. This is why Russian, Iranian, Chinese, as well as Indian, and before Euromaidan, Ukrainian naval ships were all stationed there. The Iranians actually just recently, an admiral and a military commander in the Iranian armed forces have declared that they would like to see an Iranian permanent naval presence there through a base in Yemen eventually, as well as in Syria. And those are based on their interests. So it's no coincidence that also you mentioned these Arabian states, these GCC, Gulf Cooperation Country states, council states. But NATO is there too. In fact, the French have traditionally, the French have a base in Djibouti. An American base now exists there, and NATO basically acts out of there. The European Union has extended its maritime naval presence also, which is interlocked with NATO and the United States to a degree. There's nuances. But so everybody is there. And one of the reasons is to control the strait. I want to jump back to something that Radhika said, that there's an older dynamics are involved, larger patterns. That's totally correct. The U.S. policy before the end of the Second World War was they adopted British strategic policies. And as later on, they'll also adopt German strategic planning incorporated. But one of them is to control the areas called the Rimland around the Eurasian heartland. This is part of that Rimland. This Rimland area, the Americans say this is what will make, American strategists believe, will make or break our strategy. So even the pivot to the Asia-Pacific is not new. It's pretty old. It started when the United States takes the Philippines and the United States actually signed made an agreement with the Japanese. They told the Japanese, you guys can take Korea and we will take the Philippines. So it's a very old strategy. If you look at it, who accepts the division of, who helps break up China more or less? China's been divided, Taiwan and China. Who supported this type of breakup? That focus in that region. I mean, the American policy before the end of World War II and at the end of World War II, as articulated by Nicholas Spykman, is that there should be no dominant power uniting the countries of Asia or Europe. That's their policy. And in fact, their failed economic free trade zones, you know, the one in Europe and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, they more or less want to connect the Asia-Pacific countries to the United States and the European Union countries to the United States at the expense of who? Russia and China. You know, that's why they're trying to turn all their neighbors against them. So there is an older dynamic, I think. And the last point, just to even reinforce what I'm saying, is during the Cold War, NATO had a sister alliance. It was called the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization. It is part of this military move. There's NATO in Europe and the Mediterranean area, and in Southeast Asia they had CETO, Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, and they even made interlocks. France, Britain, and the United States, who are members of this alliance, were also members of NATO. Pakistan, which was a member of this alliance, was also a member of CETO. The Central Treaty Organization, or the Baghdad Pact, which also included Britain and Turkey. So this entire part of Europe and Asia surrounded by a belt of American alliances, it's old. It's an old policy of isolating dominant countries in Eurasia.
I want to move on to one more topic. I think we have time for one more topic. I wanted to get into the French elections and the prospects of wither the European Union, because we saw the way things played out in Great Britain with Brexit. Now you've got this Marie Le Pen, who's very anti-EU, appearing to be in a context with the pro-EU
candidate Macron, and it seems to reflect strong anti-EU sentiment throughout France. So if we see France going in that same direction as Great Britain and in a certain sense the United States with Trump, what happens to the European Union, and what happens to what does that mean in the larger economic context?
I think that there is certainly one thing that unites all the three phenomena you spoke of: Trump, Le Pen, and Brexit, and that is that they're all reactions to neoliberalism. However, of course, they're all also very different. I mean, the United States, what happened, the election of Trump is its own homegrown thing, and I would say that the deficiencies of the Democratic Party were as much at fault in bringing Trump to power as Trump's own efforts were successful at bringing himself to power.
And Bernie Sanders was running on a sort of, in
Bernie
some
Sanders
sense,
was, I think Bernie
was a different
Sanders
reaction to neoliberalism.
Was definitely a breath of fresh air and a very hopeful development. But, of course, there were two different things I would say that were problematic still, although it was still a step forward. But I would say there were two major limitations of the Sanders campaign that one should always remember. One was his inability to really break the hold of the Democratic establishment on the black sections of the Democratic Party, which are highly organized forms of support and co-optation. And the second is, of course, he said very little about America's foreign policy, which is really critical. You cannot understand why American people are suffering today if you don't understand the broader political economy of corporate power, of which military industrial complex corporation power is one element, but the other is also that the other corporations are also interested in essentially trying to expand the range of their activity abroad precisely by demonizing, marginalizing, and actually engaging in threatening or actual war activities against governments that have a different conception of the organization of economic life from American corporations. So anyhow, but that's...
Looking at European Union,
if we go to the European Union, I think that there's one thing to understand. First of all, if France does leave, I think it will really there will be no European Union unless you count what will remain of the European Union will be so different. It'll essentially be a union of the German core and the southern and western southern and eastern peripheries, which especially the eastern periphery has essentially been transformed into a kind of a sort of a holding cell for reserve labor for the Western European economy. And this is the secondary status to which all these Eastern European countries have been subject. So if France leaves, that's what's going to happen. I
wonder what that means as an economic I mean, this is unprecedented since the Second World War.
Yes, I think that... So I just want to say one other thing, and then I want to come back to that longer-term perspective. So, but if France leaves, it's also very different from Brexit, because remember, Britain always had a one-foot-in, one-foot-out policy vis-a-vis the European Union. It didn't sign the social chapter. It was not part of the euro. It did not accept many of the social obligations of the European Union. So in Britain, the neoliberalism to which the British people were reacting as a largely homegrown affair, and it has as it has a lot to do with the financial power of the financial interest centered in London. In the EU, what the French people are now reacting against the neoliberalism of which the EU is the policeman. The EU imposes neoliberalism as a matter of policy, as a matter of agreed policy on the rest of the European Union. And since the beginning of this century, this neoliberalism has become much more much harsher, and that has been accompanied by a very problematic development, which is the financialization of the West European economy, which until then had remained largely focused on the productive economy. So I think that this has definitely been a regressive development, but I don't
see
by
that
banks' financialization, you're basically talking about investments and money-making money as opposed
to
money-making
money.
Things.
Yes, exactly. The financialization of works usually against the productive economy in a number of different ways. And the problem is that I don't see Mrs. Merkel as presenting any kind of an alternative to this that will be a pole of attraction to those who are repelled by Marine Le Pen and her... albeit slightly more sophisticated, but still very racist policies, you know, more sophisticated than her father, but still fairly racist policies. So I think that the other people need a pole of attraction, and that pole of attraction cannot be constituted without an economic vision of how you're going to reorganize the productive economy of Western Europe on a more productive and more egalitarian basis. So I think that that's what's at stake there. And it's interesting that the discussions around Brexit and so on have also provoked, and generally post 2008 politics in the UK has also provoked this new discussions about having industrial policies and so on in the UK. And I think that Germany also needs to go back to those roots of having a very productive economy-centered set of economic policies, which at the moment, at least, it doesn't seem to be able to do. So, yeah, we'll just have to see what happens.
Marty, I was wondering if you have any thoughts about these developments, a potential shift into an axis around that German economic hub, I guess you may call it.
Well, Germany is increasingly becoming the core of the European Union. I mean, what we saw in Greece, Spain, you can see there's the German influence is very strong in those events. What I'd like to say from a different dimension, a different angle to this is Brexit, this rise of conservatism, reactionary conservatism in Europe. It's a reaction, of course, to neoliberal policies and to the straitjacket, to the EU. You know, it's very, maybe I could use the Weberian term from Max Weber about the shrinking shell or the iron cage, as it was mistranslated into English, into it's the EU is that bureaucratic straitjacket, which is taking a, it claims to be very democratic, and the supporters of the European Union, like EU officials that you'll meet, EU officials that I've talked to, believe that the European Union is the epitome, the highest apex of the civilized human world. You know, they really strongly believe that. But I think there's the reaction in these countries is to this hegemony of the European Union telling them this is defining what life should be about in all aspects. I mean, from the governmental to the educational, the standardization that forgets about local contexts many times too. I mean, maybe this is a sociological analysis of it, but there's a reaction. And of course, think of all these the past decades, how many times that people in the Netherlands, Ireland, all these states vote against the EU, but it still goes ahead, this so-called democratic body. So that's the point I want to make. And that's why to an extent, you see what's happening in France. The sad part about this is they're looking at it in cultural terms and blaming, you know, the immigrants, migrants, newcomers. Maybe this is trivia again, but I'd like to refer you this conversation, take it back to 2011-2012. The patriarch of the Maronite Catholic Church, he met with Nicolas Sarkozy, Monsieur Sarkozy, president of France at the time, and he said, you know, you guys are supporting these events in Syria, but it's going to lead to massive waves of immigration, people leaving, fleeing the country. He said this. Sarkozy said the European Union, more or less, you can look this up to verify. He said that we are prepared
for who's going to come to Europe. They didn't say all the people. Sarkozy said the Christians. So they were ready for an exodus. That the conversation was based around this so-called exodus. So I know they knew these things were going to happen. But the point is, regardless of that, is the blame is being put on migrants, which is not really an issue. Europe needs migrants economically. It's really what is called a red herring, you know. About it's the real problems within Europe are the decay, the economic policies, the privatization of state infrastructure, the takeover of other states' infrastructure, national infrastructure, by German corporations and other countries in that economic core. Those are the problems, not people coming in from Syria, you know.
I wanted to maybe, Radhika, maybe if you have some final thoughts before we close.
I'd like to make two points. I think that Mahdi's absolutely right to point out how the problems of Europe are being wrongly blamed on migrants. And I would like to suggest that the way to think about this is very simple. First of all, Western economies always engage in a discourse about how migrants are beating down their doors in order to get there. But in reality, Western economies need migrants. They invite migrants. They clearly lay out the paths along which migrants should come. The migrants, the huge refugee influx into Europe did not occur until Mrs. Merkel said, "We will accept 1 million Syrians." That's what she said. That was Europe and Sarkozy, you know, in the days of Merkozy, I suppose, they came up with this view that we need more Middle Eastern migrants. They are relatively from, you know, relatively well-off, sophisticated, well-educated societies and so on. So we are going to take these people. We need them. The managers of capitalist economies constantly need migrants in order to loosen up the labor market. At the same time, the loosening of the labor market is more effective when you keep up a high decibel a rhetoric against migration, because what that does is it ghettoizes migrants into these relatively ill-paid ghettos and so on, keeps them constantly under threat, so that it creates a pressurized labor force, and therefore then their existence then divides the labor movement. It does all of these things, and unfortunately, the leaders of the left are not generally uniformly being able to see this. In fact, capitalism cannot operate without huge amounts of migration. It has historically been so. Originally, it took place between countryside into towns, and now it simply happens to cross borders. The effect is the same. The needs are the same. The structural needs are the same. So I think that European countries have deliberately taken in these migrants. And yes, they suffer from high levels of unemployment, but that's not the issue. The issue is that they want people who are willing to work for even less money.
Unlike the Mexicans migrating to the U.S.
No, this is for all Western countries. I want to make one final point, which is basically that today part of the revolt against neoliberalism is taking place because neoliberalism and financialization have created a type of economy in which which is unable to provide decent jobs. The only jobs it has is a small number of good jobs for overworked people who are working at the upper levels of the professions, and then crappy jobs, McJobs, for everybody else. And if this is the kind of economy that neoliberalism creates, of course it's going to create huge amounts of dissatisfaction against it. So this is on the one hand happening. On the other hand, precisely those forces who are creating a different type of economy, who appear to be capable of producing economies with greater dynamism, are being demonized. China is the first in this context, but also other countries like Venezuela under Maduro and Chavez or Russia are being demonized precisely because in important ways they represent, even though they may not be succeeding as well as China, they represent attempts to move in a different direction. So to come back to China, I'd like to make one other point, which is that at the moment the world is also poised on the knife edge between two very different options. On the one hand, of options for development for many countries. So on the one hand, you have the U.S.-centered, dollar-denominated world international financial system in which people are supposed to lay open, you know, lift capital controls, lay open their economies to inflows and outflows of capital. But they are told that if they do this, they will get productive capital. No such thing happens. Capital lifting of capital control simply leads to the influx of short-term money, whose reflux then creates all sorts of banking and currency crises and so on and so forth. On the other hand, China, especially with the Asian infrastructure development, with the One Belt, One Road policy, the et cetera, it is at one stroke using its now vast stock of financial power in order to kill several birds with one stone. One is China's own western part is relatively less developed, and these initiatives are actually going to create a huge amount of development in the western part of China. Secondly, it's going to bring into its fold, in a sense, and this fold is that of a managed economy, not an economy that is ruled by mysterious and usually volatile and destructive capitalist forces, but at least that you can manage it. Anyway, it bring into its fold power further to the west of it, all the way up to and including Russia and even Europe. And Europe is not immune to the charms of China on this matter. So the kind of long-term capital they are giving, the kind of developmental investments they are making, and they are doing this in a spirit of cooperation rather than going to war. How many wars has China set off in this very, very transformative process through which it has arisen? You know, in recent years...
Sort of like attracting, do better attracting with honey than with vinegar kind of approach.
I think, and the Chinese generally understand that. It's interesting to know that very often I didn't know this, that about the Vietnamese border being a colonial border, which is now being claimed by Vietnam. But the dispute between India and China, India is in the same position. It's claiming a colonial border rather than trying to settle the issue rationally. And China's position is a lot more rational. But I think that the world has been capitalist, broadly speaking. The dominant powers of the world have been capitalist for more than 200 years now. In this process, we have seen a very long process through which new capitalist powers or non-capitalist powers like the Soviet Union and China and so on have emerged, and they have all had one thing in common, whether communist or capitalist. They have had a very high degree of state intervention in order to bring their economy up to a competitive and level, which has been critical for their development. And so it is this process that has spread productive capacity beyond the northwestern core of Europe where capitalism began. So that's what began to develop productive capacity in countries like Germany, Japan, and the United States, later on in the Soviet Union, then in a multitude of developing countries, and so on. So this has always been, so in a sense, historically, the core capitalist powers powers have actually decreased, yeah, and productive capacity has spread. Now, more recently, with the rise of China in particular, people have been starting to talk about the Thucydides trap. That is to say, in the Peloponnesian War, he narrates a story of how the rise of Athens threatened Sparta, etc., etc. And this, in one way, is a good analogy. But there is another point, which is that by invoking this, what some people are trying to do is naturalize the idea that the dominant power should feel threatened by the rise of new powers. But actually, the dominant power, it is the responsibility of the dominant power in an age of transformation to accommodate the rise, peacefully accommodate it. It is the unwillingness of the West to peacefully accommodate the rise of China and other powers that is actually creating a lot of these flashpoints.
I want to thank both of you for participating in this expansive conversation about the current world situation. These are interesting times. And,
thank you, Michael. It was a pleasure. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madi. Thank you very much, Radhika Desai.